give me 2 minutes.
Give you an opportunity to introduce yourself before we can start with the meeting. Let's start from Satema Vunda. I don't know. Yeah. Madilani, let's start with you.
I'm Themba Mabilane, CFO from South African National Parks.
David Mabunda, CEO of South African National Parks.
Morning, I'm Wiketu Hossi, CFO from Stanley.
Good morning, I'm Tanya Abendsel, CEO of the South African National Biodiversity Institute, SANBI.
Morning, I'm Clint Winter, CFO of South African Biodiversity Institute.
Good morning, I'm Linda Makulin, CEO of South African Biodiversity.
Good morning, I'm Nigel Ndabambi, Senior Manager of South African Biodiversity.
I'm Reef Kakfir, I'm the CEO of the Water Research Commission.
Good morning, Janine Adams, Chairperson of the Water Research Commission.
Good morning, Rishmini Lakshman, Director of Water Research Commission.
Good morning, my name is Naresh Patel, I'm the CFO for the Water Research Commission. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Trevor Balser, Acting DG for Water Affairs.
My name is Pumzile Bengo from KZN, representing the ANC in the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Acting Chair. My name is Gareth Morgan from the Democratic Alliance.
Emina Jane Wakamangani, Mila Committee Minanali Yamat.
I've already introduced myself, I'm Catherine.
I'm Kilaga Matabela, the Committee Secretary for Water Affairs Committee. Thank you.
I'm Gwanele Mashim Khana, the Parliamentary Officer for the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Good morning. I'm Sengwe Kele, Water Research Commission Knowledge Dissemination Officer.
Thank you. Without any waste of time, can we allow Water Research Commission to make a
priority to look at some sort of process of collaboration, particularly as we work obviously closely with the Department of Water Affairs in establishing priorities and addressing issues of urgency. We stimulate and fund water research knowledge according to priorities, and we promote effective transfer of information and technology, and this is done verbally through open days and workshops, also through communication. And one of our biggest achievements last year was the launch of the electronic water knowledge hub. 40 years of research are now available. Reports you can electronically download them from the website. And we enhance knowledge and capacity building within the water sector, and capacity building specifically for research capacity, but as well as students, and you'll see in the annual report the contributions that have been made. In terms of the strategic context, we need to know about both the water cycle and the knowledge cycle. So at the Water Research Commission, knowledge is generated and shared and disseminated, then capacity building and transfer of knowledge. Okay, we need to understand, in order to manage water, we need to manage knowledge. We need to understand the relationship between quantity, quality and accessibility, and harmonize land use and water use to ensure that there's resource sustainability. Resource protection, the National Water Access, the resource must be protected, that's rivers, estuaries, wetlands, to provide the goods and services that we are particularly dependent on. Okay, we address through, we create knowledge, we package it through research and development so that we can address water scarcity, increase water productivity, and improve wealth and reduce poverty. So our mission is actually a dynamic hub for water-centered knowledge, innovation, as well as intellectual capital. We provide leadership for research and development, and we engage all stakeholders and partners in solving water-related problems. Water Research Commission funds far and wide. There are centers of expertise in some places around the country, but basically, if you look at our list of organizations, about 50 to 60 different organizations that are funded through the Water Research Commission. And our vision is to be a globally recognized leader in providing innovative solutions for sustainable water management to meet the changing needs of society and of the environment. Thank you.
In terms of governance, the Water Research Commission and the leadership of the shareholders of the Water Environment, together with the workshop to ensure the governance, we manage the five costs of governance. The board has five functioning committees, that's the audit, the human resources, the research policy, strategy, remuneration, and the research committee. The WSC has complied with the Water Research Act, the PFMA and treasury regulation. In terms of the way the company is assessed in terms of performance, we use the balanced scorecard methodology. The areas that we are assessed under is the stakeholder relationship, financial perspectives, learning and innovation, determined processes, and organizational transformation. In each of these areas, we are undertaking the WSC and all subject subjects. In terms of human resources and the demographics of the Water Research Commission, 50% of our staff is female, and we're made up of 63 internal agency candidates.
Good morning. We received an unqualified audit report. Our financial statements are prepared in terms of GRAP, which is the accepted standard. We, however, received one instance of matter.
Can you all
We did receive, however, one emphasis of matter which related to a prior year, and there were no other major audit findings. In terms of the financial position or what we previously called the balance sheet, we have a fairly strong balance sheet with no unfunded liabilities. There was normal growth in the account and then the trade and other receivables, which were mainly due to the water research levy accruals. The cash which we had at year-end was slightly higher than the previous year, but it's mainly in respect of commitment for multi-year research projects. Hence, they can't be regarded as surplus cash. There was growth in trade and other receivables due to higher accruals for research-related costs. Our retirement benefit obligation obviously increased from year to year due to higher medical aid inflation.
the bulk of this liability is in respect of the post-retirement medical aid liability, which I previously said is funded by an asset. The ratio of current assets to current liabilities is fairly healthy, nearly in the region of 3:1. We then look at what we previously called the income statement. We did, however, show a 2.4 million rand deficit, but it is mainly due to non-cash items, typically like depreciation, provisions, and actuarial valuations. Our income increased by 8.6 million, which was mainly due to an increase in the water research levies, which do increase year to year, and leverage income. 83% of our total income comes in the form of a water research levy. And this water research levy is receivable in terms of the Water Research Act. Our operating expenses only increased by 3% year on year. Again, the main contributor of that was HR-related costs, which increased in the region of 10%. Then we have a 100% owned subsidiary, which is actually a property-owned company. That company also received an unqualified audit opinion. The major item, obviously, on that balance sheet is the investment property. We did, however, show a 0.4 million rand loss on the income statement, and that's mainly due to the servicing of the WRC loan. The main tenant is the WRC, which contributes about 90% of the income. Thank you.
I was speaking with about the research and, you know, the projects, and I would have liked to have some time to talk to you about impact and what we achieved as, you know, samples of what we have done, but I wouldn't have the time. It's in the annual report, so you can read about it. I want to start to begin to say that we work with many partners, but one of our main partners is the Department of Water Affairs, because a lot of what we do is end up to actually support the department from point of policy advice and providing knowledge for informed decision. But we do work with other government departments, and we work with many partners, and I think you have all probably heard in the news that we are about to sign tomorrow a memorandum of understanding with ESCOM, for example. But all entities around the table are linked to WRC projects, and we have given you the knowledge review, which provides you with an outlook of all projects, and you will see the weather, the SABO people, the biodiversity people, and even the park people are actually part and parcel of certain projects. Now, our research is divided into four key strategic areas. Water resource management addresses the notion of how to assess the level of the resource, how to understand natural and human-induced impact, and understand element of policy development. WaterLink ecosystem is helpful to do with the management of the resource, but it's mainly to look at the processes, the utilization, the rehabilitation, and that's not only include aquatic ecosystem, but also wetlands. So we do a lot of research also on wetland rehabilitation. Water use and waste management looks at the whole notion of service and institutional management issue. We link very closely to local governments, both to SALGA and to specific local government entity. We're looking into supply and treatment technology, be it small scale or large scale. We look at municipal wastewater and sanitation, industrial mine water management, sanitation, health and hygiene education, and we started something that is still in its infant year. We try to actually get innovative water-saving devices. We call it the Water Smart Fund. Lastly, the other use that we are addressing is agriculture. As you know, over 60% of our water are used for agriculture in the country. So we want to actually understand the use and the management, and we look at water for food and fiber production, for fuel, wood, and timber. We look at biofuel, for example, and we look at agriculture and the use of water for agriculture, for poverty reduction and wealth creation, a lot of it to do with infield rainwater harvesting, a lot of homestead gardens and nutritional meat parks, and water resource protection and reclamation in agriculture, because agriculture is also a polluter.
Overall, it is from year to year change a little bit, but 50% of the funds are actually given to the resource side, which will be water resource management and the ecosystem, and 50% to the link, and differ from year to year because the cycle change, but overall there is a division of 50%. From point of knowledge creation, a number of projects, you know, that are happening, we have given you in those slides both the accumulated figure for the last 5 years, but also given you what is the average year to year. And you can see that we are between the 50 to 100, vary from year to year, as for how many we are thinking and how many we are starting. It's about around 300 projects, 280 to 300 projects that we run a year. Again, it depends on the size of the project and the way we actually fund it. The aim of all those projects is, and that's where the Department of Water Affairs, you know, is an important partner and stakeholder, is providing knowledge and informing them for decision-making processes, informing the way we monitor and assess tools, and we can even assess policy to see if the policy is actually and the strategy is working, making available a range of new and improved technology related to water resource management and the provision of water and sanitation, and of course, researching climate change. And we have moved from actually understanding the whole notion of a research per se for climate change into adaptation and adaptation at local level. And we have moved from actually understanding it at the level of policy to a level in which we say what will mean to water utilization in agriculture, what will mean to actually using it for, you know, water and domestic. And here is also the link with ESCOM because a lot of elements of energy and water comes about. During the year under review, the 2010, the WOC supported 284 research projects. 80% of them were active, what means they either started that year or they were ongoing, because you know our research is ongoing. Normally research projects run for 3 to 4 years sometimes. That allows people to do master and PhD studies also. 20%, 57, has been finalized during the year. The active projects comprised of 165 ongoing, 62 new, and 105 were solicited. What we mean is that sometimes the research community, according to the need of the sector and the need of the country, requires some direction. So we put together a term of reference rather than open it for innovative ideas. And there we call it solicited, and from year to year, the balance of solicited to actually more innovative projects from the community changed. Last year, it translated to 46 of the projects. I'll give you an example. We had only research on agriculture with commercial farmers a few years ago. Now we have a lot of research into emerging farmers and homestead gardens and so on. We only had wastewater treatment, but no sanitation professors. Now we have proudly a number of sanitation professors in the country. So through term of reference, we provide direction of the funding. During 2009-10, the total investment in knowledge creation, sharing, and dissemination landed up to 105.8 million. We also leverage income. So working with our partners, we actually get money from elsewhere for research projects. That can be global money from 115.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Acting Chair.
Yeah.
I'm dyslexic. Sorry about that, you know. That's about 20 million comes from different sources of money. It can come from global sources. We, for example, get money from Irish Aid for a project in Eastern Cape about school sanitation and energy and education. We get money from the EU for certain projects, but also the Department of Water Affairs, the Department of Agriculture, provide support to projects and to also capacity building and dissemination projects. So we run the Water Information Network, which is part of the Masai Mambane program, for example, and we support capacity building in the project. So basically, it is supporting directly research projects, but also support capacity building, knowledge sharing, and dissemination. WC continue to excel in support to students. Last year, 562 students have been supported, and 62% are coming from historically disadvantaged backgrounds. The WOC have also taken on itself to support NEPA and the African Unity, and we have been very, very hard with NEPA to build Center of Excellence for Water Research in Africa. I'm almost there. This is a number of activities that we have been supporting. We need capacity in the future, so we support young scientists and try to actually have young professionals in the water sector meet and meet with the sector, which is very important to our future. We have worked with the department and UNESCO into the framework for education and training in water, which is to do with water resource management. We support the department as for the South African Youth Water Prize that goes into Stockholm every year. And there are many other activities, I wouldn't, you know, numerous activities in which we are supporting various courses, training material that the country is in need of. For knowledge dissemination, we run from workshop to exhibition to demonstration. You all receive our water wheel. We also have a scientific journal called Water SA, and we produce, which we have given you in the tech, policy and technical briefs. So we take a research project, get into two pages, and we provide you with an overview of what are the recommendations from that research. 57 research projects have been finalized. We published 102 research reports. We published 30 research briefs. Some of them you have. We had open days, and we have done a number of activities, various activities, knowledge cafes, and various activities, technical workshops in which we share with the sector the knowledge. And I thank you. And I'm sorry I couldn't actually talk to you about specific impact projects, but they are there. Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, without any waste of time, it's time for questions and comments. Honorable Morgan, you'll be followed by Honorable Mangani.
Thank you to the Water Research Commission for their presentation. It certainly appears as if the organization is well run. Congratulations on your unqualified audit report. Let me say on a personal level that I appreciate the work that the Water Research Commission does, and I try as much as possible to read the reports that you produce and find them very, very interesting and valuable. But that leads to my question. Is you guys produce reports. Those reports are hopefully used by policymakers at various spheres of government, as well as NGOs and the rest. And you produce a lot of things, and it's quite frankly all very good. How do you reassure yourself, and how can you reassure this committee that in fact the research that you are producing is actually being read, used, and is being regarded by the stakeholders who read it as excellent product? So what work do you do to actually go one step further from the production of the excellent material that I believe you produce, to be able to know that what you're doing is correct, and for example, you should be doing that and not something else?
Thank you, Honorable Martin. Honorable Mangani.
Thank you. It's so difficult because I thought today I will speak my own language because it's what I know better. So this committee must also assist me because I compromise myself always speaking other people's language. And then it seems you don't want to learn the language that I'm speaking. It's difficult for me to express myself in other people's language. I will just cry. Thank you very much for the information and your work that you have done, as my colleagues have already alluded to. The question or the clarity that I want to know sometimes there are people who are doing research in our water. I want to know what is your relation with other countries that does the research in our water, specifically in our sea. If you have knowledge, I want to know if you have that relationship, did you benefit something that will assist our country? And then the other question I want to know, what is we are doing research, I want to know, because when we look to TV, we look everywhere, we will find we're still having a challenge of polluted water. I want to know, after your research, do you sit down with the Department of Water, as I heard that you are partnering with them? I want to know if you are passing that knowledge, because to me, if you are passing that knowledge, we couldn't have the problem that we are having now, because the research, as you have given us here, it says you have done a lot, but is this productive to the department? Because I want to know from you if it's productive. Because to me, I have thought we don't have researchers. As I look at the water all over the country, polluted, but we are partnering with this department. When you look at the newspapers, I'm not just so much in reading newspapers, but if you look to the newspapers, it says a lot with heartbeat water. So I want to know what is that. Are we doing this research and put it in the archive, or we are doing something about it? Because you said you also have this technology that you are doing. I want to know where does it assist us, that technology? Is that technology in the books or technology that will assist us? Because we need something that will assist us. We can't waste time of sitting in the meeting chat as an always crying and said we don't have researchers. Our water is polluted. Whereas we have such a huge contingent of people who are dealing with water. I want to be clarified, Mina Namuta Samasto. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Manganye. I don't know, I will make a follow-up on the RTGSF board then. You can all see this speech. This is Algar. Maybe it's not your competency to say really what's happening in this country. Can we allow our people to drink such water? Is it fair? Really, are we doing good for this country? Are we honest to our people to say we are members of parliament, we are government officials, we are whoever, we name them all, but our people still go through this hardship. Secondly, I just want to check with you whether you also do research around the mitigation on acid mine drain in South Africa. And if you do, can we get a report, your report to say what are you doing and how are you going to assist this country in that? Thank you.
How about you? Thank you. And having my colleagues can help, but I will try my best to answer. You know, I don't have answers to everything, but
I do my best. Okay, let me start with the first question. It was, and I thank you very much, Mr. Morgan, for actually complimenting us, you know, from point of the research produced, actually reduced, and I think this is actually a repeat question that comes, you know, also from the other question is what happened to the knowledge produced by the WRC. Now you ask how we assess it now. Very interestingly, you know, from experience and being, you know, years at CSR before, you know, joining the WRC, it is clear research is
long term. That means that often you actually will go through a number of research projects, accumulate knowledge, and then implement. And throughout the period, you try to educate, you try to build awareness. And what we try to do is that in the reference group, in the steering committee, have the end user, the decision maker, so they are part and parcel of the project throughout the time. What we have introduced a few years ago in order to measure if things are done is impact studies. So we will take an independent group of people that are not involved in the research and say to them, we have four major objectives. We want the research to make an impact in the country. As for the life of our people from point of socioeconomic issue, the health of our population, and the overall environmental element, because water is part and parcel of environmental sustainability. So we basically ask independent researchers and say, we have done research on membranes. A lot of money have gone into research on membranes. What is the impact? And those researchers come back to us and say, that's the good you have done. That's what you could have done, you know, better. So by now, I think we have done 10 studies like this. Some of them are used cost-benefit, you know, elements, and some of them are actually indicating where are the problems from point of impact and elements. Now, impact is like a value chain. Impact is not per se us. And I remember honorary acting chair that the previous meeting, you know, the acting chair said he will give us teeth so we can be having a strong bite into implementation, but we are not the implementers. We can only provide the knowledge. So when we say we partner with the department, we provide the knowledge. So they will have informed decision, but we cannot actually make anybody do what we say. We provide advice. When we come to implementation, there are other elements. There are capacity in the country to implement. There are decisions that cost money. There are different prerogatives to what to do first. You know, there are political elements that come into account. So we provide the knowledge. We cannot actually ourselves implement. We go as far as actually having demonstration projects, training material, talking very, very closely to the end users. Now, talking about that, you talked about the river, and you talked about the river being polluted. Now, this is not a simple thing. It's not just the river. It is many things that will create the pollution of the river that we have to understand, and that has to do with the dam, because the activities for dam is about the rivers, the falls, the water that falls into the dam. But many years ago, and, you know, this is really one of the famous success projects, we started with river health. You know, we built beautiful indicator onto river health. It was adopted not only by government. It was adopted by municipality, and parliament got to adopt the river program. And we sit in a country where our rivers are polluted. So you say to yourself, certain things will add value in that way, but at the same time, you have other problems. Now, problem with our river is simply the notion of what falls into the river. So we had the Green Report. And I want to, you know, emphasize, there are issues, like guided point and non-point pollution. So what actually ended up in our river is not per se protect. We need to, and that's why we said we need to do protection. Effluent that falls into our river should be of such quality. And it's a matter of policing, because we have to police effluent quality. And there is plenty of research. Now, Artibis for them was a subject of research for many, many years. Now, Artibisburg Dam is basically a victim of what is called eutrophication. There is too many phosphate and nitrate in, and therefore algae grow. And I myself have done a lot of research on this algae many, many years ago. And this algae produces a toxin. It's a very small little toxin, but it actually creates liver problems, you know, and in some cases in the world, people even died, not to speak about animals, you know, that died from it. But they are mitigating, and there is actually a program of how to clean and keep the dam clean. So it's not that, you know, our partner and the department as a stakeholder not looking about activities for them. There is a major program on rehabilitation of the dam and understanding the dam. So it's not that nothing has been done, but we need to control what goes in. Now you're talking about people drinking the water. The purification system in this area are very advanced, and they have powder activated carbon, and that actually takes away everything. It takes the smells, it takes the toxins. So we don't expect anybody to drink from the dam. Drinking dam water is very bad to your health. Drinking the purified water in that area is fine. Those people will be healthy. I just visited Circle Boss, you know, from Point of Rainwater, taking the Val River water. They produce water. And I brought in there people from all over the world. You know, we had the Global Water Research Coalition, which is a research institute from the UK and Switzerland and the US. And they were looking like this. And they were so impressive at the size and the quality of what we have in rainwater. So I think we should always, you know, saying, you know, we're not doing that, but we are doing good things. And again, the technologies are simple, but the technology are robust and the technology produce drinking water of high quality. So I said, what happens with our polluted river? It requires more money to clean, but we can clean. The other thing that we develop in this country, and we should be very, very proud, we are the pioneers, the whole world are using our the biological nutrient removal. It is a South African innovation, the NBR. And the thing is that our wastewater treatment is so advanced that sometimes it's very hard to manage. And we need to look into it and we need to provide support. And I'm hoping that the blue drop and the green drop, which we have been part and parcel in supporting in the country, we will get into a very, very good situation. So we need to be hopeful. We need to be critical, but we need to be hopeful. And I think the fact that we have the knowledge and the fact that we can utilize it is the good bonus for that country. What we have been spending a lot of time the last 2 years is repackaging the knowledge, putting it together into training material, into operation material, into foster to actually make the knowledge more available for the people who need it. And I think it's very important to understand knowledge dissemination. So from just having a report to actually disseminating the knowledge is a lot of work, and we are putting a lot of effort into it. You asked us about acid mine drainage. I'm very proud to tell you that through funded research, mainly done by Rhodes University, the WSC has a family of patents that actually take acid mine drainage, mix it together with sewage, and neutralize it. This is licensed to Airbus. And Airbus has been piloting it in a large scale, and this technology can actually clean acid mine drainage. That's one. Secondly, I don't know if you know, but what is Wintec now in Malaleni? Malaleni. They drink acid mine water. Because what happened is, and we have taken the whole of WRC, is there, it's actually quite easy to clean, and with current technology, the thing doesn't have a lot of microbial, you know, bacteria and things like this, disease. It's mainly acid. So they actually neutralize the acid, they push it through a membrane, and they have very high quality drinking water that is produced from acid mine drainage. Latest research says that you may in the future even block the acidity from being formed. But this is futuristic, you know, this is not there yet. But currently, we have been involved in the task group, you know, onto acid mine drainage. We've been for many years, there was an intergovernment, you know, group that dealt with acid mine. Research, export solution is available. It's costly, and we need to understand how to implement it, which is beyond us. But the cost of acid mine drainage to the country is huge, so we need to really understand the prevention and the cost benefit of it. Lastly, you asked me about a relationship with overseas people. I just told you that we have coalitions, we work with various researchers, we work because it saves us money. So sometimes when, you know, other countries want to invest, we work together with them. So we have projects on asset management, on energy and water, together with other research organizations and funding agencies. Through that, we managed to get donor money into the country. So we do have very good global presence. More so, I'm very proud to say we have a presence in Africa now. And when the Ethiopian came here and said they want to build a water research commission and we want to study how we're doing it, we were very proud about it. So I think we can contribute, you know, from point of learning from us, you know, and be proud of what we have in the country from point of our achievement in Africa nowadays. So I think I hope I have addressed everything. Thank you, Acting Chair. Okay. Thank you. Is there a follow-up?
Yes.
Honorable Morgan, before the other one, then.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Partly you have covered me with the research, but you didn't give me your answer. I'm not I'm not sure if you have understood my question. I said there were two ships that were doing the research here in South Africa in our water. What is your relationship with those people? Did they pass that knowledge to you that they were doing in the water? Do you know about it? If you know about it, that's why I said if you know about it, did you benefit something from those people who were doing the research from our water?
Honorable Morgan.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your comments on the impact studies. I mean, just by way of comments, I don't want to put a question. In my personal opinion, I mean, yes, a lot of work has been done on eutrophication of dams, without a doubt. And this is really more directed at the department. I would suggest that using Hartebeespoort Dam as an example of a project which makes good use of your research is not a good example. In my opinion, the research of the work actually going on Hartebeespoort Dam is anything far from scientific analysis of a response to dealing with the problems of that dam. It's quite frankly a Mickey Mouse response. And that brings me to my broader point, is that there is a lot of focus in South Africa on rivers, on river health. But not enough focus in terms of dam health. Now, I know you guys have done tons of work on eutrophication, and we know what's eutrophied and what's hyper-eutrophied in South Africa. But what concerns me is that actually the management responses to dams across South Africa is lacking. Because everything is about Hartebeespoort Dam, which isn't a mess, and it's been in a mess for 60 years, quite frankly, so it's nothing new. But the Mickey Mouse stuff that they do there affects all dam health management in South Africa. Because all this money is put there by the department, so, I mean, I understand the sensitivities of how you work on it. But actually South Africa needs a dam health, increased dam health research and management instrument program for all dams across South Africa. Because it's not happening. And I fear that, in my opinion, the department can say separate, the failures of the Hartebeest management system make it actually much harder to implement dam health management systems in other dams across South Africa, actually. Because surely good work means that you apply a particular management instrument, and you might say, well, dams are different. Sure. But the best research is research which is transferable, which means that you can take components of the work done in one dam and implement them in other dams, rotoplas and the like. And I have big concerns about that. I also have big concerns about impoundment research in South Africa. And then the last point I want to know is, where are you at the moment with your diatom assessment protocol? And is that being sufficiently well funded? Because I hear that it is not being sufficiently well funded and being held up. You know, and as you probably know, you've probably heard those kind of things before. But are we any closer to complete management instruments in that regard? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Morgan. I would like to make a follow-up on the #BSF1 thing. You see, this committee, though I was not part of it, visited Hartebeespoort Dam.
The report that I got from my honorable member next to me was that in Hartford, yes, for them, they are using worms from Mozambique that are used for consuming algae in that dam. And I wanted to know from her, and she could not explain further to say what happens to the excrete from the worms. And what happens, you know, we know that they are doing research, but, you know, we need to be properly informed because we are here representing people. And people are phoning us from RCPS for them to say this is the situation. If green water comes out of the tap, really, we need to be serious about it. We understand your research, it's a long-term thing, but we need a mediate. Are those worms, if at all, they are worms that are used for cleaning the dam? Are they worms doing what they are supposed to do? What is it that is happening? Thank you.
Okay, let me try and answer, and I will also ask my chairperson. She is, you know, into ecosystem research, so she can maybe also help a little bit about it, you know. Let me talk a little bit about, you know, our dam, you know, and dam research, you know. To a very large degree, the knowledge is there. We are not the implementer. We will not run the program. So basically, taking the research into control, in my opinion, it's a bigger problem than the dam. You're talking about, you can't separate river from a dam, because at the end of the day, the compound problem is not the dam, it's actually what comes into the dam. And what comes into the dam, if it's polluted, actually creates an accumulation of pollution in the dam. So you need to really understand, the main problem is effluent. The main problem is actually, look, we practice inland a practice that globally we practice it, which is not very healthy. We take our sewage, we create waterborne sewage, we clean it and we throw it into the river, then we take it into the dam, and then we clean it and we drink it again. And this is a best practice, and this is practiced all over the world for centuries. So actually, if we would not actually have a waterborne sewage, we would not throw anything into the river and we wouldn't pollute the river, but this is not the practice. And this is something that is new in thinking, you know, the whole element of separating of urine for feces and eco-sanitation, when you say you don't throw your feces back into the river. If you do it, you actually pollute. But I think put that aside, because this is still science fiction in a way, you know. If we look into what we have right now, we need to manage effluent. If we manage effluent, we will not get that level of phosphorus and nutrients in the water to make the water green. Algae will always be there. Algae always been there. We tried hyacinth, and hyacinth blocked it. There was no algae, but the hyacinth actually made the dam unusable and not right either, you know. So we do have a problem of having too much nutrient in, especially in algae. This for them, because there is a hell of a lot of reuse happening. You know, people that drink from Hartebeest brought them, and we actually proudly say, we go to the world, we say, we drink water that has been to 7 kidneys already, you know, and which is true in a way, you know, because we reuse and reuse our water, and that's the consequences. As for the Mozambican weeds, I can tell you from where I sit, the worms, okay, I want to tell you something. ARC, we have been funded by us, and this has to do with working with water about actually weed control, aquatic weed control. They specifically also look, at like hyacinth, for example. They can make the hyacinth drown, you know, by actually getting holes in the flotation system of the hyacinth. From point of actually getting the algae disappear, no real yet success, you know, studies, you know, to that point of which, you know, somebody gobbled it up, you know. So I don't know of anything, you know, credibly scientific that I can share with you at this point about it. I don't know. I've also visited the waterworks in Hartebeest for them, not very long, and we were, you know, quite impressed with the way they actually cleaned the water. So I don't know, maybe recently it's not as good as it was. So that's not something that I didn't know that happened, because we are not into the control of the actual, you know, active activities there. You asked about diatom. We have been involved in diatom research for a number of years. If it is applied widely, I question. Can it be a good monitoring element? It is. Funding it further and further is not the issue. The issue is actually making it implemented. And that actually requires knowledge sharing and actually getting into more dissemination. And in there, we might require more activities, and we might require the people who is doing diatom research that will do it. Researchers always want more money, you know, and it's always not been researched enough. So one has to look at it in perspective and say how you go into taking the knowledge elsewhere and how to get that into becoming a simple tool that can be used, you know, as part of the essays that we are doing from point of monitoring. Honorable member, I really apologize. I don't know which researcher you are talking about specifically. There are a number of groups. There are the Germans, there are some Dutch people, they different people working in this country. Some of them are working closely with us. So I know about the activities they are doing. Some of them, I don't know if I knew exactly which groups and where, I can give you more material about it. Sometimes a university or what was called previously Technicon, University of Technology, get into agreement with some others to do work. I get very angry when people are using us as a lab and we are not no added value to the country. So if I get German professors who want to send students to do research in here without benefit to the country, we do not wish to actually support that. So just be aware of it. But once I know which country and what who are you talking about, I can provide the information. I promise I will research it and get you the information. Thank you. You want to ask? Okay. Ah, okay.
Thank you very much. I think a follow-up will be done with the Department of Water Affairs. Can we move to the next presenter? Sandy? 15 minutes, Rama. Oh, 10. I said 10.
Good morning, Honorable Acting Chair and Members of Parliament. I'm going to skip through this very fast. You all have received, sorry, can I ask you to just change for me? You've all received a hard copy of the presentations. I'm not going to go through it in detail, and many of them you know about the South African Natural Biodiversity Institute. Let me direct you, otherwise it gets confusing. Go backwards, sorry. You all know about the South African Natural Biodiversity Institute, and our mission is to champion and explore and conserve and use and appreciate and enjoy our exceptionally rich biodiversity. Next one. Just to give you some information about Tembe, in case any of you are new, and it's very nice to be able to be in the same room as my colleagues from water, the water sector, so make take an opportunity to tell you a little bit about Tembe in case you don't know. It was created in 2004. It's built on the foundation of the National Botanical Institute, which included botanical conservation research, herbaria, and gardens. It has over 100 years of history of botanical exploration and science. It's located now in 9 national botanical gardens. The newest one was in Huntam in the Northern Cape, and we are planning to open a new one in just about East London in the Eastern Cape within the next year or so. We have a total of 719 staff members, of which half are garden management staff. And I wanted to just give you a very thumbnail sketch about our finances. My CFO, Mr. Quackley, will give you more information. But I just always want to impress on you, Acting Chair, that for all of this, we do this job with amazingly little money. Our annual budget is about 331-32 rand business, basically. And our expenditure on a cost-cut operation is 343, so we are approximately in 11.8 million deficit. We receive 150.8 million from the state through our MTF grant.
we managed to eke out an own income of approximately $44 million, and this is really from gate takings, which I find appalling that we even have to charge people to go into gardens. Actually, we would love to not have to charge them, but that's from gate takings and from management fees we get from projects. And then the rest is really donor funds and other grants, which we have been very, very lucky over many years to have a reputation to receive so many donor grants, but not only from organizations like Water Research Council, but also from JEPs, from the World Bank, from UNDP, et cetera, UNDP. But of course, the global situation has meant that all those kind of grants are reducing over time. So we are a unique institution globally because basically we do the science, we package the knowledge, we give policy advice, and we implement all along that value chain. And you might be pleased to know, colleagues, that this is an arrangement that is considered to be world's best practice, and we get many visitors from Brazil, from Costa Rica, from Korea, who come to look and see how South Africa has done on an institution that combines all these things. This is just a slide showing you that the where our 9 natural botanical gardens are in your pack, and tells you about annual visitors and how long it's been around and how big it is. The next picture is just a pictorial version of that, and so we're very pleased indeed to be looking forward to an Eastern Cape garden, and the next garden we have our eyes on is in Limpopo, and that's the 2 gardens in the next 2 years that we're going to focus on in expanding as part of becoming a national, having a national footprint. The next slide just briefly tells you our new structure. We have downsized our structure, and I'll talk a little bit about that going forward. And the next one is our goal, which you've all got in your pack. I just want to focus a little bit on our key result areas. Our role is to understand biodiversity and the bioadaptation to climate change and any other impact on biodiversity. We also do models for integrated biodiversity management. KRA3 is really about the gardens, which I think belies the breadth and width of that responsibility. KRA4 is policy advice. KRA5 is the work we do together with a whole range of other institutions, including our commitment to building human capital in our sector. And KRA6 is really about our corporate finance management, HR systems, IT, etc. So just to give you a sense of our key results area, which is understanding biodiversity, and I won't talk about all the other things. I highlighted just 1.4. All of them are important, but I highlighted just 1.4 because developing a comprehensive biodiversity monitoring framework, which is in basically to be able to inform the minister, government organizations, and the public eventually about the state of biodiversity in its breadth is our job, and this has been this is one of the areas that we're grappling with, and I want to just raise that. Otherwise, all the other key result areas are really important in that area. Under KRA2, again, all of them are important, but I want to just focus on the lessons from mainstreaming pilots that we are doing. And you might know that we, within our grasslands work, for example, we have worked together with a range of business organizations and local government entities in order to mainstream some of the lessons that we've learned on these pilots. And there's a lot of information on that in our annual report. I didn't want to go into much detail. KRA3, which is really around the gardens, and I wanted to highlight the one additional garden in an underrepresented biome, which is in the Eastern Cape. Just to talk a little bit about this, the old method was to go off and then buy the land, either from an existing landowner or transfer the land from the other state entity that often owned the land. In Sambi's case, it's either been donated or bought or transferred. But in the case of this new garden in East London,
Rav Islan and in Kwelecha Nature Reserve. We are not going to acquire the land. We are going to work together with the Eastern Cape Tourism and Parks Board, who own and manage the land, and that we're going to look at a different way of conferring National Botanical Garden status in a joint venture with another entity, and we're very excited indeed. We've been to visit Kwelecha. It's a little bit run down. It's got huge potential. It is in a biodiversity hotspot. And we really, and as you know, Eastern Cape is very interested part of the world in terms of biodiversity. And so we're really looking forward to an Eastern Cape park, Eastern Cape garden that will be almost like a hub for biodiversity in that part of the world. Policy advice. I highlighted again, this has been a very, very important area, and I think MP Morgan's question about how do you take the research work you do, the science you do, how do you package it for the very many clients that you have, including the public, and how do you then make it, you know, that whole chain, that whole channel, in order to persuade. And I think, to be honest, colleagues, that we have a very, very good relationship with our department. In many, many cases, the work that we do is plugged directly into decisions made on policy, and I'll talk a little bit about it later. The next slide, again, important issues, but I'm not going to go into detail, but I want to say that one of the things in this management work is that we recognize as a one-stop shop for accessing biodiversity information. And I really would want you all to look at the biodiversity advisor. I sit on the Global Biodiversity Information Facility. South Africa is quoted at CBD in Japan. South Africa was quoted as best practice in this over and over and over again. And I think often we don't look at it, but other people look at it. And here, my colleagues have really gone out and had relationships with institutions where information lies, sometimes moribund, not being used, not being extracted, and with very little money and support, have actually allowed that information to come into the public arena. And this is really what we aim for, is an ongoing journey on how do we get biodiversity information, popularize it much more within tipping off people's tongue than it is at the minute, and not elitist as I think it is perceived. KRA6, as I said, is really about our operations and finance. I just highlighted too, because financial issues are so important. My colleague, Mr. Kwasi, will talk about that, and that we maintain our brand and our corporate identity both nationally and internationally. So, next slide, please. So, I've given you lots of information about progress against the time, but and it's a pretty one, kind of highlights with a little red line. But I have highlighted a few things you might be interested in. The high-level report on climate change and biodiversity, which is published on behalf of the CBD and which we co-chaired, which is halfway through there, is really something that shows that we are really playing at the cutting edge of global innovation around understanding of climate change and biodiversity in the globe. The other thing I wanted to just point out is the publication of the Red List of South African plants. And again, we're the first mega-diverse country to do this. We have had visits from Brazil, from various countries, but particularly Brazil. So Brazil is the one that's got 40,000 plant species. We've got 20. That's the kind of mega-diversity Brazil has. And what has been really great is that the head of the Brazilian Environment Department came to visit us, and then we've had an exchange. So some of Sandy's really young researchers, by the way, people like Tele Raimondo, who have worked hard on this, they've gone to Brazil to teach the Brazilians how to do their red listing, as we were the first megadivers. And it was also a talk at CBD that we had done this successfully. It took 7 years, but we had done it. We're now teaching the Brazilians to do theirs in 5. And thus cutting costs. And then the other point I just wanted to raise, which I highlighted, which you might be interested in, apart from everything else, I think is really important, and I hope you enjoy it, is that we described a new species, Moraya vuvuzela, which was launched during the World Cup. And so the scientists that worked on it, like Dr. Manning and stuff, you know, they're the ones that actually did the scientific research. But the actual naming of this plant was named by a lady who was just retired, and she was the woman who managed the cleaning in Pretoria campus. And we were talking about this plant and what would be a good name, and Bafana Bafana wasn't acceptable. And she was just talking, we were talking in the kitchen, and she looked at it and she said, this looks like a vuvuzela. And in fact, that's how we named it. And so we have honored her in a plaque as Ms. Poppy Nkosi, who named the Moraya vuvuzela for the World Cup. Apart from all the other things, I just wanted to highlight. So in the model for integrated biodiversity development, I think the interesting one I wanted to highlight is bullet point 3 there, which is the work that we were doing with the department, but really leading it at the request of MINTEC, in coordinating and facilitating a very complex process of refining and standardizing the sensitive geographic areas listing process. And this is really, as the department is striving to make the EIA process rationalizing, streamlining, and trying to make it reduce the cost of business here. And that's what we've been working with and leading it, doing that work. I can say with the department, in this case, we're actually doing the main work. The other area I wanted to just highlight is bullet form 4, which is the offshore biodiversity plan, and it's a highly innovative plan. The work that we've done with our biodiversity offshore work, offshore marine protected area network work, also considered to be an international leader. Then the other bullet, just two from the bottom, I just wanted to highlight was the stewardship site in forestry owned land that was proclaimed and gazetted under the National Environmental Protected Areas as a nature reserve in KwaZulu-Natal, and we therefore have saved or protected 900 hectares of misspelled grasslands, and this is some of the work that our grasslands project does. Under gardens, just to say that we generated 36 million or so from the gardens in the year in question. It's the highest ever income amount generated by Sandy's Gardens. But as I say, the thing in the tale is that I actually feel that children should get into for free and that pensioners should get in for free. And so although this is a good to have, ultimately it is always with a bit of sweetness that we report that we've got more money. 10,000 learners or so went through our education garden-based programs, and just to say that we're busy reviewing and developing and benchmarking some of our garden-based education programs. And finally, the Chelsea Show won a silver medal. And the reason why we didn't win our usual gold, is that for some reason, UK made a huge clamp on what kind of plants can come into. And for some reason, there wasn't enough communication between the horticulture show and those bringing in plants. And so that we had lots of regulations to comply with. On policy advice, also just want to raise, some of you who have got institutional memory will remember the invasive alien species reg. Well, we have done the work, and now it's over to DEER to do the reg. We also have submitted just last week the SICAD crisis management plan that we've worked on and submitted to DEER. It's gone now to MINTEC. It will go to MINMEC next week. But not that I want to rain on my colleague's parade, but I actually think that we're not taking notice enough of cycads. And while rhinos are great, iconic plants, and, you know, the cycads really are under crisis in terms of the species. And so that's around cycads, my plant of cycads. I think another area in this policy advice, we worked together with Sandparks and Department of Environment Affairs and led the National Protected Area Expansion Strategy and the National Biodiversity Framework, both which was developed by us together with our colleagues, and launched at the Green Economy Summit held in May. And a copy was handed to President Zuma, and we actually extracted some for his speech. The other point I wanted to raise there, which is also a very big milestone, is the production of the second national report on climate change, which was approved by Cabinet. And finally, I think some of our colleagues were there, Acting Chair, we launched Biodiversity for Development in Japan at COP10, and also considered to be world's best practice and highly praised by the World Bank and Global Environment Fund, etc. Here is our five, also lots of important, it's difficult for me to know which one should I highlight, except to say that we're actually building a cadre of black MSc and PhD climate change students. We have launched the website Biodiversity Advisor. You might be interested in this, we have finally signed the historic MOU with the Botanical Society of South Africa, which really reflects, I think, a very different, more grown-up relationship. As you will remember, there was sometimes a great difficulty in separating SAMBI from the Botanical Society, and now not only do we have priority of our relationship, but Botanical Society actually gives us some money every year of their membership money, and that we negotiated through that MOU. And then Lewis Foundation has supported our human capital development strategy for the biodiversity sector. I know you want me to wrap up. The effective systems and processes. So I want to little talk, just go to the next slide. I want to just talk about the challenges and just really say that for 150 million from the state that we get, we do a hell of a lot. And I think we really would like your support in lobbying for us to get additional funds. We've done major budget deficit cuts. We've reduced our operations size. We've reduced our personnel budget. And we are really at the point at which we just need additional money from MTN. The other challenge is really to make the value case for biodiversity, ensuring that it creates jobs that you can see, that's visible. The other challenge is to deliver on our biosystematics and collections mandate. I think those of you who heard me before, taxonomy is a boring area of science, but yet without it, none of us would be able to do our job. And so this whole area needs, we've now got a plan. The budget deficit management, I talked about that. We reduced personnel costs. We just want to say that last year, in the year in question, no one got a performance bonus, although people did perform very well. No one, not from the CEO down to the lowest gardener, that everybody agreed that we would not have a bonus of any kind. And that was part of our cost savings. So in our budget cuts and rationalization, we made no redundancies. It was a commitment made. We did not want to have redundancies, so there's natural attrition and some change in our business plan. Budget priorities, I've listed them there. I don't think there's anything more to be said. I want to just quickly hand over to my colleagues for a few minutes just to talk a little bit about our budget.
Thanks, Acting Chair and Honourable Members. Just quickly, this slide is basically to show the comparison between the previous year's budget and the year under review, where it shows under differences. It basically shows where we've made major changes and major adjustment cuts in terms of the budget deficit management strategy. I will not talk to the figures. And also the next slide is just the showing on the right-hand side that we had a budget that was approved according to the allocation letter, and on the other side we have to do some further budget adjustments, cuts, and we're just showing the budget after restructuring, also showing where we've made the cuts in the column for differences. So it's just to show that we are very vigilant in terms of containing costs. And then the next slide is just other news of revenue. I think the CEO has already alluded to the admission fees, and we have some project funds, among others, rent received, some sponsorships, some discounts, and some sales. Just a breakdown, and that I think this one, the CEO has already alluded to the fact that we've had a decrease overall from income in the previous year. We had about 3.3 million, and then it decreased by about 1.6 to 331 million, and then also grants have also increased due to the climatic decrease due to the climatic conditions that we did not raise the external funding that we had hoped for. And I think we were not immune to the economic condition. We're also doing own income. Rent received has somewhat increased because of we were chasing our tenants who we know are also going through some hardships, but we just became more vigilant in terms of collecting income due to the organization. Other income, really, is just a number of other things, professional services, guided tours, commissions, and the like. On the non-current aspect, I just mentioned that one, total expenses increased, mainly due to salary increases, but whereas on the other operating expenses, we've actually shown major savings. And our current assets also showed an increase in terms of cash and cash equivalents. Our consumables, which are actually a part of some stock, have also decreased. In terms of managing our working capital to make sure that we use money vigilantly. And then on the non-current liabilities, just want to mention that the non-current liabilities increased. The reason for the increase is actually because of our post-retirement medical aid benefit, which we are managing through the help of consultants to make sure that we remove the liability from our balance sheet. And we have moved retired people onto the momentum policy through the help of consultants. We know that a lot of public entities are also going through this; they're also facing this problem. But I think so far we found a way of managing it. And I think we are prepared to share this information with other public entities. That's how we are doing it. On the current liabilities. I think, Chair, in the interest of time, I won't talk to all of these numbers. But just to mention the last point, that we also got an unqualified audit report. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable members, any questions or comments? Honourable Morgan.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and thank you for the good work that Sandy does. It's a great credit to Sandy that our biodiversity work is so lauded in other parts of the world, and that is a credit to South Africa and this organization. So well done. Well done as well on the unqualified audit report. We expect that, obviously, of all entities. But, you know, many entities in South Africa don't get unqualified audit reports, so, you know, it's worth highlighting that and congratulating for that. My question is that of all the entities that appear before this committee, this is the only entity which appears to generate correspondence to MPs about internal staff problems. Then, last year, I know the CEO, you know, spoke about the thing. And since our last meeting, you know, we've had, and falling into this financial year, we've had issues which were raised about internal staffing matters in the Mail and Guardian in August 2009. In my preparation for today's meeting, I always do a review of all adverse publicity that organizations have reported to us get. And therefore, I would be very interested in the CEO considering this fall into that financial year to obviously talk to us about what happened there. And if I am not mistaken, and from my summary notes, it included an allegation that one of your employees, Christel Mays, had procured services from her husband. So if you could respond to that. I know that there was another employee, a Ms. Koyo, who instigated a forensic investigation. And who apparently is no longer in the employ of your organization. Why is that? And in terms of emails received by MPs actually only recently, there's another complaint which has come to us by, I think it was Ms. Rondo, who is on suspension as well. Why? It's important that we air these things in public. Of course, our job as public press to ask these questions. And then the reasonable question to ask is, you know, details, complaints by employees, you know, can be genuine or they can be spurious. And I'm quite open to both of those possibilities. Can you reassure us that in the case of these complaints, considering that it appears to be at least one of these people has lost their job and another is on suspension, that these are based on sound reasons and labor law and not any adverse action against employees who may have genuine concerns about HR issues or procurement issues in Sandy? Thank you, Theo.
Honorable Mangani.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks for the present that you have presented us. A part of what my colleague have said that you're supposed to tell us, I want to say, apart from those issues that my colleague have raised, at least you have done us proud when we were in Japan. I was so proud to be part and parcel of people who come from South Africa, even from the department that I'm oversighting over. I was so proud to see South Africa as this leading negotiator. I thought if you can keep up that good work, even here in South Africa, here at home, we must be a best practice to other departments. We must share knowledge, especially to our the component of water. We must be always there because really we need departments that do better things like yourself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mangan. Dr. Adams, last year you indicated that you have got you've got 71 interns and students. And I would like to get a report from you to say, are they still in your program or are they done with their education? Also, I'm also interested in your alliance vision plan to say you have got a project. And I would like to know whether you also do that in the rural areas, because if you go through Makwatruf, there's this purplish plant that is taking over our traditional vegetation. We've got the Wedderberg blue, we've got the Lantana Camara, we've got the Bed Brandy, and you know, animals are dying because of this invasion plant. To say, are you still on? Where are you dealing with this problem? That's what I want to get from you. The other thing you spoke about, Lowveld, in your last briefing, you spoke about Lowveld National Botanical Garden NRS 5. That was a proposed one, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Amendment. Proposed amendment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I get a briefing on that?
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. My question is to know whether do you have an awareness program to give information to the people in rural areas as well as at schools in those areas, because they are beautiful indigenous areas with beautiful indigenous plants, where the municipalities can identify them to be protected, to be the gardens. And you consider only those gardens in
urban areas, or we also look at the areas there in rural. And as per your report, you have also more mentioned that you have more activities and events that have been held by the Sunday. Maybe in future we'll be grateful if you can also consider inviting the members of the committee just to have knowledge and get information on what is happening on those botanical gardens. And also like maybe in future as a committee to have some of our meetings in those beautiful gardens. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Abrams. And can you also give us a report on the Mujaji Saikat? To say, are you really taking care? Is Mujaji Saikat in your area? And if it's not, I'm told that Mujaji Saikat roots can be used for making drugs. To say how is it protected? Because I know that you can't plant or keep Mujaji without a permit. But really, is it under control? Is it free for all? What is it? Because I'm from Limpopo and I know what is happening.
Thank you. Can I answer? Thank you, I think. Let's start with a difficult one. Auntie Morgan, let me give just do a bit of a chronology here, making sure that I stick to fairness. There was an accusation made on one of my senior staff members that her husband had benefited from work. We did a forensic audit and found that there was no basis for that accusation. That forensic report was accepted by our audit committee and by our board. One of the issues with Ms. Coyle is that despite that accepting of the forensic audit, that she did not accept it. And as I say, only one of the reasons why the divisions arose in that. In dealing with this matter, we sought recommendation. We first of all sought performance and mediation processes, and eventually was advised that the best methodology for dealing with this would be an arbitration process. So we went through first ordinary management engagement, then we went through a formal mediation with the help of the board, and then finally went through an independent formal arbitration process with Ms. Coyle. And at the end of that, the independent arbitrator gave advice. In fact, you know, arbitrators don't give advice, they give a ruling, which indicated that she needed to leave. And the board decided that she would be paid an additional 3 months or so, and she then left. She then took the organization to the CCMA, and the CCMA threw it out, saying that they don't have any jurisdiction. At the minute, it's at the labor court, and the labor court is going through all the tapes from the arbitration process. We have... I think, and Mwaketi also acts as head of corporate services, we have stuck totally to the letter of the law on this, and we feel that the Labour Court will throw it out. Because the Arbitration Act, as you know, that it's quite a strong and powerful act. It's a very fair and arduous and costly process, but that in fact it is a final end process. I hope that answers as much as I can on that. Ms. Zondo, yeah, I've got an. Mr. Tiwa Zondo, ironically, was the person who actually accused Ms. Mays originally of inappropriate or impropriety. Ms. Zondo also was a union official.
she, and we've had a whole year of issues. And why I'm being very careful is that we in running an organization and dealing with a matter like this, how do you ensure that total fairness is achieved? But and in the first round of dealing with some of her misdemeanors,
almost at the end of a disciplinary process, the first disability process, I was instructed to talk to them. And when that kind of thing happens and the person continues to behave bad, you really need to show due process. And it was causing a morale issue.
She was a union official. I was hoping to speak with my HR guy as I was outside, because we have now had a disciplinary process with her. It has been delayed a number of times due to her ill health, which she has produced the medical report, and we were having the beginning of the disciplinary process in the last week, and it has been delayed to the 24th of November, and we hope to go through due process with Ms. Zondo. But as a partly as a consequence of this, we have had to engage with our union, NIHAO, quite substantially. And I'm pleased to tell you, and it's in the report, we had quite a historical relationship building exercise with them on the 31st of March, which just falls into the year in question. And out of that came real clarity about expectations of the union, expectations of management, roles of the union, et cetera, and including a revised recognition agreement with the union. And I think that if you want to know more about the relationship building exercise and the outcome of that, I can send you a report. But we were very pleased indeed with the maturity of our union, and obviously encourage union membership and see them as a partner in delivering our mandate. On the alien invasive species work, just to say that we have got a major program called the Emerging Weeds Program And I was just talking yesterday with the head of the emerging weed unit, Dr. Philip Ivey, and he was giving me a report around for the first time we actually have a national footprint around a project, and we have appointed a Limpopo coordinator of works around emerging weeds. And if you want any more details about the, what is really considered to be a very successful program in all areas of South Africa working on emerging weeds. And of course, the weed that you talked about, and I was just trying to remember the name, pom-pom weed, the pom-pom weed, is one, although maybe the word emerging is not a good word, but it's still considered to be a very important weed and invasive species. And in fact, we have had a great focus on the pom-pom weed nationally. On the Mojachi cycad, I want to say, Acting Chair, that I will make sure that you receive a copy of our cycad crisis management plan, of which the Mojachi cycad is part of that, and our recommendations to the department about management of cycads. As I mentioned earlier on, cycads are under threat, so all our cycads, and there's a need to relook at how we manage it as a nation. But what might be also interesting for you, Acting Chair, is that the CBD negotiations that your colleague talked about earlier, for the first time historically in 20 years, since the Rio Conventions of 1992, there has been, and Dr. Mabunda will help me on this, there has been an agreement globally on access and benefit sharing, which, as you might know, has been a global issue of argument about how does local indigenous people get value from information and knowledge and plants that they have always known to be of value, economic value, medicinal value, social value, etc. And so that for the first time since the Rio Convention, there has been, in 1992, there is now an agreement. And I really would, and I've said to all my staff, that it really is worth us reading the CBD declaration in detail to see what are those agreements. The other question was around the amendment on the low-fault garden. If you will remember, SANRAL requested that we alienate a piece of the low-fault garden for the building of a road. It was a very small piece, but nevertheless, because it's part of the conservation, despite the fact that it's a smaller piece of land, it did impact on the size of the conservation estate, and therefore came to Parliament, and that piece of land was alienated. We have now had a conversation and a discussion with an agricultural college that is adjacent to us, and we are in negotiations with them to include some of their land into the estate. But again, Chair, the days of going and getting a piece of land and fencing it in and declaring it as part of the conservation estate is really over. What we really want to do is to have a joint agreement with another state entity, which is what it is, and assisting it to be part of our estate rather than alienating it into the garden. And that's the engagement that we're having with agriculture at the minute in the local. Awareness programs, yes, just to say, absolutely, the previous chair of this committee, we've taken a lot of effort to invite her to various launches and engagements that we've had, particularly in Cape Town, because that's where most of you are based most of the time. And I think we'll extend it to the whole of the portfolio committee. I think you would be very interested in the very many events, arts, launches, expos that we have in the gardens, and a particularly very active East Coast Sabosh Gardens. You might know Indalo Yeto, which is the organization that is really focused on awareness, and we work closely with them. But all our education programs is around awareness of biodiversity. But we think the most important awareness that we need to inculcate is with our municipal colleagues, who often have green spaces and manage green spaces within municipalities, and that they're not national botanical gardens, but they are gardens anyway. And many of them were for leisure and pleasure and tourism and improvement of quality of life of people. So one of the things in our municipal garden, in our municipal mainstreaming program, is assisting municipal areas to upgrade and improve their green spaces in the work that is under Crystal Maize and Sinobuyo Matai in the organization. Okay, and my colleague wanted to add in addition to that.
Chair, as part of the awareness campaign, we are also involved in greening the nation, particularly in the rural areas. In Vembe, we've also won an award in recognition of the good work that we're doing there jointly with the schools, the police stations, and other public entities like clinics, where we do bore water holes, what do you call it? Bore water, and where we do nurseries and greening the nation, planting trees all around, which is not necessarily within the gardens, but involvement with the community and also indirectly creating employment. Thanks, Chair.
And just finally, I wanted to just say that this is an organization that organically grew from a lot of different organizations. And when it moved from being the National Botanical Institute to being SANBI and the expansion of its mandate, that there had not been a proper organizational review, design, etc. And in many ways, the organization was quite fractured in what it does, in the array of things it does. And what we've done in the last year is engaged the help of TAO, the Technical Assistance Unit of National Treasury, to basically re-look at the whole organization, its culture, its ways of working, the empowerment of people. Remember, this is an organization that ranges all the way from semi-skilled people all the way to world-class scientists and everything in between. And so that's been a very, very interesting exercise. It's in the report. I didn't highlight it. But what we've done is we've done a diagnostic phase for the whole organization. TAO has interviewed everybody at all levels, in all locations, asking a number of questions about the organization, the culture, efficiency, effectiveness, its mandate, etc. A whole lot of matters have come out of that diagnostic phase, including the issue around communication, the issue around leadership, the issues around conditions of employment. We now have developed a working plan and which is to be approved at our board meeting at the beginning of next year, which basically will form part of SAMBI's sustainable transformation process. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Abraham. I'm sure we are behind time. What I want to say is that ARC has got a project of removing alien plants. You, Sandy, Mangali, so, and all of you can be able to deal with the problem. That's how I see it. Because there are so many entities that are to deal with this problem. Is it not possible? I'm just throwing this challenge. Not for you to respond, to say, can't you people have a common way of dealing with this alien plant problem? Thank you. Mangaliso, over to you. It's half past. Thank you.
Honourable Chairperson, honourable members, today's presentation is looking at the last financial year's annual report and financial statements, but I wanted to contextualise it in biodiversity, heritage and economic issues. Isimangaliso, this is a World Heritage Site because of it, for three global values, one being biological diversity, it's biodiversity. When you talk about birds, for example, and we saw Tanya Arden's slide, 65% of South Africa's birds, for example, occur in the Mkuzi section of Isimangaliso. It's unique ecological systems in a range. I think another way of looking at it, they're more wetland types in Isimangaliso than any other place in the world. And I think that in itself. And then finally, it's pure beauty. And UNESCO has about 176 countries to describe to it, and all 76 countries have to agree that this place is of global beauty. And when you go to UNESCO meeting, a debate going for a long time, and they debate what is this global beauty, which is intangible. And eventually one person stood up and said, I know my husband's really good looking and beautiful, I don't know what the rest of the room thinks. And everyone of course started laughing, because the site or place might be of regional beauty, but all the countries have to agree it's beautiful. It's like being a Miss World or a Mr. Universe. And Isimangaliso qualified in that. I think the other thing that's unique about Isimangaliso is when you become listed as World Heritage Site, you do a comparative study, say where else in the world is a place the same or similar. In the case of Isimangaliso, there is no other place. There is no other place. And I think that's a very useful background to why the world sees this as important, why the nation sees this as important, and why it's viewed as important locally. And World Heritage is really, for me, about two things. It's about celebrating human skill and inspiration, and it's about celebrating the gifts of nature. And in a site like Isimangaliso, while it's a natural site, we also have to celebrate human skill and inspiration, as you do in Robben Island and the cradle of humankind. Yet, with this tremendous wealth, this natural wealth, the Isimangaliso exists in a situation of poverty amongst natural plenty, as our president put it when he was opening a road and developing this program. The socio-economic neglect from the past government, the area before Isimangaliso was consolidated was on a very low growth path, it was a negative growth rate, and the key challenge to government was to shift the development trajectory and begin to end the paradox of poverty amongst natural plenty, which is, again, what the heads of state were talking about when they launched the Lubombe SDI. And the idea really is three countries in one day. There's a trilateral minister committee that oversees the three countries project, and in the province we have an MEC's oversight committee that assists with blockages. Progress against this project, and I'll be very quick now because this slide has been presented before, malaria is on track. There's been a malaria eradicated from Isimangaliso and large parts of Mozambique and Swaziland. I'll give you the figures if you want. Improvements to borders and access. Major roads have been built and opened, opening up the way for a tourism route, which we now in the second phase of developing between Mozambique, Swaziland, and South Africa. Transfrontier parks are in the process of being established. There's been progress with the key transfrontier park with Isimangaliso, which is that with Ponta do Ouro in Mozambique and all the way up to the peninsula.
Mozambique has now proclaimed their first marine protected area, 70 kilometers from the Ponte Aura border north, and in the process of doing a World Heritage application. This is important for Isimangaliso because the currents come from the north, and anything that happens in Mozambique affects Isimangaliso. And importantly, in developing a tourism destination, Mozambique is our partner in cooperating to compete in the international market. We can't see them as competition. This picture shows what the area was like before the process started. The top right-hand road is the main road to Manguzi, Kwangwanaz. The bottom left-hand picture was the main road to Mbazwan, which is the second biggest town in that area. The road you're seeing there today has had further improvements with pavements put in, water put in. So the road was really a means to an end, not an end in itself, to improve people's quality of life, but also create the opportunity for economic growth. The authority specifically was established by government, and its establishment was to protect and conserve the World Heritage values, but also to ensure that there were benefits delivered at a local level and a development in the tourism economy. And I think what's quite important is Isimangaliso is a development agency with a conservation mandate. We're not a conservation agency, and that, I think, differs us a little bit from the traditional approach to conservation. And the challenge to us is to implement a development strategy and a conservation strategy to produce economic benefits in an area of market failure and limit our alternatives. This is an area that hasn't seen significant investment or hasn't seen significant investment in the last 20 or 30 years. Looking very quickly at where we are in implementing government's vision, the major tourism roads we've discussed, the N2 and the Lubombo Road, the R22, are complete. We are well on the way to completing the community investment and access roads that have been discussed and planned. Internally in the parks, there's been a significant shift in the tourism product. 16 parcels of land have been consolidated to one. When we talk about commercial plantations and dealing with aliens, I think there is a very tightly aligned strategy with SANBI, South African National Park, and ourselves and other agencies. And year on year, we're clearing about 30,000 hectares of aliens. And again, everybody has to work on this because this battle is not yet won and won't be won for many years. The park has been fenced. At the process, we're finishing the final section of the park. It will open it up into one open ecological area from the top of the Lubombo Mountains to the sea. What that means from a conservation viewpoint is you put eland back in the park. They used to exist here. They'll be able to go from the mountains to the sea. What it also means is with black rhino, we'll be able to introduce more black rhino into a section of the park, creating a population of continental significance. Infrastructure development is well on its way. We'll look at a little bit more job creation. That's a year under review. There are 5,300 temporary jobs, 30 permanent jobs created. Training combines this, and we'll deal with enterprise development a little bit on. So effectively, Isimangaliso has been consolidated. It was consolidated through the World Heritage Convention Act. We're now consolidating functionally, and progress is far advanced. It is not complete, and I'm always cautious to say something is a success, but certainly UNESCO has publicly stated that the South Africa's World Heritage Act and Isimangaliso has been for them an example of best practice. But UNESCO really is about preservation of World Heritage sites. What South Africa has done is said you have to recognize the context of their existence, and you won't be able to conserve them without actually dealing with the development issues that surround parks. From an infrastructural point of view, in the year under review, we planned the following projects you're seeing up there. In this financial year, we've actually tendered them and in the process of implementing them. And in the next 18 months, there will be a substantial shift again in the product offering in the park, which then obviously translates into empowerment, growth in tourism, etc., etc. Indicators of economic growth, and I'm going to look at the last 10 years. A recent study completed earlier this year shows that there's been an 89% increase in the number of tourism businesses in the park, in other words, since we've been established. At the same time, there's been a 46% increase in bed numbers, and occupancies have gone from below the national average to above. When we started this program or process, there was a negative growth rate in tourism in the area. I think importantly, during these recessionary times in the last two financial years, we've seen an increase in gate numbers. In the year under review, there's been a 6.4% increase in gate numbers, and revenue, own revenue, increased by 27%. Key focus has been land claims and land claim settlements. At the start of this project, 100% of the park was under land claim. The preferred model is settling land claims. The RLCC settles them. People get title with restrictions in title. There's then a co-management agreement. And a key part of that is a beneficiation basket, One part is the annual payment, the revenue sharing agreement. In the year under review, just under R500,000 paid to the relevant claimants in terms of revenue sharing. When we develop new lodges, equity partnership is given to local land claimants. In other words, we see our mandatory our BD partner as being our mandatory partner, which is a relevant land claimant. In the year under review, the former minister, launched a program with 98 entrepreneurs, of which 28 qualified to get grants, and we're now establishing what might be South Africa's first rural hub around the park. And this program is funded and will grow and double in size over the next two financial years. Land care has been spoken about. In the 8 years that this slide reviews, under the under review, 3,500 contracts, which is under, were issued, creating 35,000 local people jobs, and R70 million has been put into land care over 8 years. Infrastructure, again, starting with experience on the Lubombo Road and working with the National Road Agency, it's been a big investment into SMMEs. In the last 7 years, 164,000 jobs have been created, and R42 million spent through 43 SMEs on infrastructure. Currently, under this financial year, the last financial year, and the one coming, R36 million is committed to SMMEs. I think importantly, tourism skills development has been an important focus, and again, we train for jobs rather than just numbers. From our programs, 80% of people trained have been employed. The craft program has been ongoing. It has been through a checkered patch, but again, this financial year, we focused on it again, and there's budgets and funding coming in for that. The craft program has, for example, supplied Mr. Price and all sorts of other retailers. Backing up the land care and infrastructure training, vocational skills training is obviously an important component. Innovative programs started in the financial year under review with the art development program, with the opening of the Mosvita Stadium. Artwork from this program was hung in the presidential suite. There's been a number of other commissions given. This is supported by a cultural heritage program and about the youth taking ownership of their culture and actually using culture to inform park management and indigenous knowledge. It's ongoing. This is a production that was done for a major conference, international conference of local artists. Community-based natural resource harvesting is a very important safety net. Our big event every year is in May, when 3,500 people from across KwaZulu-Natal come and harvest Nyama to make Nansi mats. This is the only major site left of Nyama in the country. Setting the quotas, getting participation and managing it is an ongoing process. Food security, much of the park is surrounded by very sandy soils, the wetlands, and specifically the peat soils are fertile for a few years you use them. There's a lot of pressure for people to come in and actually farm within the park, and creating alternatives is hugely important. The year under review saw 39 gardens, 900 beneficiaries, with 400 women being trained. Education for all parks and SAMBI and water research, all the questions that have been asked today, as where the future is. In the year under review, we had approximately 200 schools coming into the park on assisted program. We need to grow this program to 600. We have 600 schools surrounding our park in our Ubujeni district, and it's a major focus. This specific component of the program was supported by oceans, coasts and oceans, and it's a marine component. The Silvana Bay, for example, not only do you get loggerhead leatherback turtles laying, and this is the last major site left in Africa of leatherback turtles, you also have cedar camps. And yet 90% of people living around the park don't access the park unless it's on formal programs that like this. Very exciting in the year under review was the start of the education program. The year under review saw 10 students from around the park going to university and technicons. This current year we're taking in another 30 students, and next year there'll be another 20 students. So in 3 or 4 years' time, 50 students living in and around the park will qualify in science, conservation, tourism, business. We're talking to our land claimant committee to see if they're going to come on with the resources so the program becomes sustainable. But for us, this is certainly deep empowerment. These are the future managers and CEOs of the entities. In the picture, I think you see our chairman, Mvusim Samang. And importantly, on the left, you see the lady who is in charge of the World Bank for Southern Africa. This program for her is small. he had a portfolio which goes to civilians, and yet at this launch, he talked about this being the most innovative program that the World Bank's involved with in Southern Africa from a conservation development point of view. What the donors like, especially international donors, is the integration, the vision, bringing in other departments, and actually linking conservation to development, to a regional development plan, which means you actually be able to go to scale. Annually, we have about 80,000 to 90,000 people access the park on New Year's Day for free, mahala. In this year, there was a whole safety component. You can see the stage up. It's a challenge at the same time as being an opportunity to manage these kind of numbers. But we must realize that Isimangaliso includes 9% of South Africa's coastline. So this is a reality and an opportunity to move forward on. Looking at our financial analysis, in the year under review, we had two independent national assessments, including World Wildlife Fund and the Department of Environmental Affairs, and Isimangaliso came up fairly high or well. Since our inception, we've had unqualified external audit reports, and in the last two financial years, we've had performance reports, which have been endorsed by the external auditors as achieving our objectives. Looking at a summary of our financial performance, this is really as a mini income statement, and for interest, I've taken the 7 years or 8 years we've operated, as well as the financial year under review. Our revenue since we were started in 2003 has been 432 million, and the year under review 61 million. I'll just highlight as you go down, total expenditure has been almost 230 million. Our surplus before depreciation has been 139 million, and our surplus deficit after depreciation in the 8 years we've operated to be 76 million. In the last financial year, it was a negative 5.7, largely due to depreciation and non-cash items. I think just touching on the highlights again here, in the years we've operated, 16% of our total expenditure has gone to employees. In other words, our staff and cost of the entity is 16%. The government norm, the PFMA normally targets 30-odd percent, most entities are far higher than that. And I think our cash expended on capital, in other words, of all our revenue, 31% has gone to capital expenditure projects and infrastructure projects. Looking at some of the trends, our revenue did dip in 2009. It will increase again in this financial year. We've increased our park revenue in the last financial year by 27%. Looking at expenditure trends, our costs will increase during these next financial years, largely because of our increase in fences, roads we're building, and park infrastructure, and it stresses the need to continue to grow our own revenue as we've been doing. And I think of note for us was in the financial year under review, 85% of our expenditure went to BEE, qualifying expenditure went to BEE. I think the year before was 80%. The challenge of using biodiversity to generate economic opportunities, and this is a very serious issue that needs debating at all levels, is very often these areas exist in areas surrounded by poverty, very high expectations of delivery from communities, and we're currently in a recessionary economy. Generating investments and new investments in a recessionary economy is challenging. Coordinating government's regional economic development strategies and opportunities is also a challenge. For example, in the Dukuduku Forest, you've had to align several government departments, national and provincial cabinets, to actually get a development implementation going to try and find a sustainable solution there. And then the debate of optimizing revenue versus maximizing revenue. We're increasingly under pressure from Treasury to maximize revenue. And yet you're managing a World Heritage Site where by definition development has to be limited. At the same time, communities expect and need and have the right to certain deliveries. So government has settled land claim settlements in a certain way. It includes title, it includes a beneficiation package. That comes at a cost. And in essence, the management agencies of parks have to service those agreements. These are just issues I think that need to be debated and considered going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member, are there any? Honourable Morgan?
Thank you, Mr. Zalumas. and congratulations on your financial performance, including increase of revenue. Very sympathetic of the challenge you have with having to pressure to maximize revenue, considering what your mandate is. Nevertheless, some comments. Have you had any involvement at all? I know it's a little way away, with the land invasions in Ndumo Game Reserve. And can you give us your comments there? It is, in my opinion, very problematic what has happened there. And it is, you know, in the kind of general locality of Isimangaliso. And I'm concerned, of course, if action isn't taken to find some sustainable solution there. Of course, we have to consider the welfare of those people who have moved into that reserve. Then these kind of actions could become increasingly, increase in occurrence, in incidents in Isimangaliso or neighboring conservation areas. So could you give us your views on Ndumo and what, if anything, your role has been in that particular park? You've also been much lauded in the press over the last 18 months on your stand against illegal and unauthorized structures within the bounds of Isimangaliso Park. Could you just give us a further update on those things? What are you taking a sort of zero tolerance approach to these unauthorized structures and acting against them appropriately using the law? Then, with regard to your integrated management plan, which was completed around about the end of 2008, that was a draft. What is the status of that particular plan at the moment? That should be fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable. Yes, thank you, Chair. And thanks for Isimangaliso for the comprehensive presentation. And thanks that Isimangaliso is doing a good job on the creation of jobs. As now we have heard that the government has established a new growth path, where 5 million jobs should be created in the next 10 years. But the concern is of the sustainable jobs. How many of these jobs are sustainable? And how many jobs are sustainable in your program? And also, on the SMMEs, you say there are 48. Do you have any challenges facing those SMMEs? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Over to you.
Thank you very much. If I just respond, and all the questions came. The Ndumo question is hard for me to comment on because it doesn't fall under our mandate. So it's possibly inappropriate for me to comment in this forum on it. What I am able to possibly to discuss is Ndumo in relation to Isimangaliso. I think any, and I'm using this word in inverted commas, land grab situation or lawless situation places a risk to all conservation areas immediately in the area or adjacent. Duku has always been upheld as a precedent, and I think Ndumo, if it's not timelessly resolved, could be seen as a negative precedent. I think that's probably where I should stop with Honorable Morgan's member's permission. In terms of unauthorized developments, and maybe it's the other half of the Ndumo question, Isimangaliso was left with no option but to take a stand on unauthorized developments for two reasons. One is, and I'm quoting an MEC, it's a form of economic theft. When illegal or unauthorized developments happen, they don't actually happen in a regulated environment. They rob communities of their development opportunity. They're very often unsustainable. They don't create jobs. At the same time, as they begin to eat away a white ant, the conservation area's very reason for existing. In the case of Isimangaliso, it's World Heritage values. Government led with the national minister in one case, and then with ourselves and his Imvelo case in Wildlife, and the other five cases went to court with six unauthorized developments. The court ruled in the favor of the state in all six cases. Demolishing happened. In the one case, there was a contempt order issued. There's now taxing orders being issued as we speak, because the cases were awarded with costs, and the site has been largely rehabilitated by Isimangaliso. We are now entering what we call phase two of this compliance program, and there has been a voluntary compliance offer made to several of the remaining illegal developments or unauthorized developments. Those who come on board and agree to voluntarily relocate, we will then stop pursuing the matter. Obviously, the prosecuting agency will do what it does. We have no control over that. Those who don't comply, we will then go to court with, and that's where that matter rests. I think the result of the actions that got taken have been to actually to reestablish a sense of lawfulness in the area, an area which is only about 100 kilometers from Ndumu, where I think court cases haven't actually happened. And prosecutions haven't been followed through. Your question in regard to IMP, there was extensive consultation, development of an IMP in 2008 and then reviewed in 2009. The IMP has been approved by Isimangaliso's board and it has been submitted to the department to be considered by the minister. And we're hoping early in the new year to have our IMP approved. We have submitted the IMP as a forward-looking IMP with a start year being 2010. It's a five-year IMP as required by law. Honourable Member Bengu's question. Sustainability of jobs is always a challenge. We were fairly concerned in Isimangaliso in our first few years about that, but year on year we've managed to establish 3,500 temporary jobs. So the jobs that are temporary have become sustainable because the aliens don't go away. The challenge has been as contractors get phased out, because we work largely within the working for water system that was developed with aliens, is how do they then find jobs in other areas? Initially, there was no budget from working for water in their phase out process, so we found budgets to start training SMEs so they could actually tender for other work. Every year with the workers created, there are permanent jobs created, because Isimangaliso doesn't have its own works department, etc. All work is tendered out. All maintenance work is tendered out. And that has created a lot of jobs. The challenge for Isimangaliso is going to be the transition from finalizing, as one never quite finalizes, but largely completing the infrastructure and redevelopment of the park and the establishment of tourism jobs. And the recessionary climate for us is particularly challenging, because we are looking for new investments in the area. The area hasn't previously seen large investment by outside companies, and that is really the next big step for Isimangaliso, is to secure one or two of those kind of investors. The 48 entrepreneurs discussed are separate from the SMMEs. SMMEs are, for example, land care contractors that get employed every year. The entrepreneurs are business people. In the selection of that program, there's quite a rigorous selection process, and people have to be entrepreneurs. And they have many challenges. And the 23 of the 48 entrepreneurs who qualify for startup grants in certain businesses are getting ongoing support through the program, which is now establishing a rural hub. Initially, we were a little bit naive in that program. We thought these entrepreneurs would all be tourism entrepreneurs, but in fact, a lot of them aren't. They're construction entrepreneurs. Some of them even have hair salons, etc. So one has to be quite open-minded in that process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Follow up, Honorable Morgan.
Thank you. Mr. Delimus, with regards to the IMP, what you have submitted to the department, have there been any significant changes to the draft IMP? And I ask that particularly, I know that a lot of people comment on it, and I know that, for example, one reputable organization, the Oceanographic Research Institute, provided certainly from their submission, a pretty damning assessment of the INP. Were any of their submissions taken into account in the final INP? And so, can I didn't hear you quite frankly, who assisted you or led the court with the court cases in those six different unauthorized development? I think you said cases in wildlife and someone else. Thanks.
In terms of the IMP, we dealt with it in a very rigorous manner in the same way as we deal with EIA processes. So all comments from members of the public or organizations are captured in the comment document and there's a response given to all comments. I think importantly, although not legally required, we also had the IMP reviewed by UNESCO as well as by the IUCN as well as Ramsar, and they certainly were very complimentary about the IMP and made some changes. Where we didn't have the expertise, we refer those questions to specialists that we use and external reviewers. So people's comments have been seriously considered. In terms of the ORI submission, there's a deeper story. And the IMP is not a scientific document. It is not there to be, quote, academic articles. Actually a document that has to be owned by everybody, local people, international community, and the public. So it's a framework, and it makes a lot of provision for specialist management plans, etc., etc. In terms of the court cases, the one court case on the beach camp was led by the Minister of Environment with Isimangaliso and Ezimvelo Caves and Wildlife. The other court cases were Isimangaliso as the lead applicant with Ezimvelo Caves and Wildlife. If members would like any of those proceedings, we have them available digitally or any of those rulings.
Thank you. Honourable members, without any waste of time, I'd like to request Santa to make a presentation. Last year they lost about 38 rhinos. I don't know this year how many have they lost. Because the Kugan is not from there, but about 12,000 rhinos are interested in knowing how many are still alive in Kugan National Park.
Thank you very much, Chair, honourable members. In the interest of time, I will not go on a blow-by-blow account of the whole annual report, but my focus will be on national issues that have been of interest to the public, but also to this committee in the form of some of the inquiries that came from this committee or members of the committee to the department, and just to address those issues in the context of the annual report. That's our iconic animal, the elephant. Just by way of introduction, Chairperson, that's what a national park is. It is a national symbol. We may try to give it a biodiversity definition, but it's beyond that. It's something that makes us proud as South Africans. It makes nations to be proud. If you go to the United States, they will always talk about the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone. And with us, it's the Kruger National Park and Table Mountain. And indeed, visitors come to these shores to see those parks. And that that saves us time to go through the dictionary of explaining what a national park is. The footsteps of the leopard will lead us to some of these issues, but I'm not going to confine myself to all the visions and other things, Chairperson. Nothing has changed. We will deal with the financials and then go through the rest of the other issues that I think members would be very much interested in. But without much ado, I'll invite the... Maybe before I invite the CFO, this is our business plan, it's our strategy, our map. In a nutshell, it depicts the biodiversity philosophy that we follow. We are no longer managing animals or species at an individual level, but at an ecosystem level. The biodiversity philosophy says we must manage for ecological heterogeneity, and in short, the heterogeneity refers to changes in time and space within a habitat and within many habitats in an ecosystem. For example, animals, in terms of their numbers, will change, will move from one place at different times, and we need to capture the entire movement, the entire, all those changes in time and spaces. And that's how we manage national parks now. We manage them for that ecological effect, the ecological processes. Over to you, Temba, in terms of the finances.
Thanks, through you, Chair. We have had an excellent year with regard to the financial performance of the organization. Just a few highlights, Chairperson. You can note that our income from our tourism activities has grown up by more than 9%. It's around 9.4% or so. And then we welcome the government grant from our mother department, although the growth is very minimum, just to note that. And then the total income year on year is around 19%. And with regard to our expenditure, you can see that the impact of our cost curtail measures that were put in place were very successful. Our operating expenses year on year with a slight drop, and on our administrative expenses, there's quite a drop there as well. And compensation of employees, there's only 4% growth, far below the applicable CPI at the time. And I must note that even at executive level, there were no performance bonuses paid. It was only filled critical position. So our cost containment that's put in place in the financial year under review, 10% worked. Just to explain the surplus of 67 million, the 67 million is not money in the bank per se. It has been inflated though due to the way we account for our land grant and other capital expenditure, which are accounted for in the balance sheet. Pure savings from our operational activities is only 21 million. Thank you.
Thank you, Temba. Chairperson, this is really the typical product that brings the revenue that the CFO was talking about. We have no intention of changing it. It's very important. It's really the landmark feature of our national parks that really describes the sense of place, the ambience, and the character of the kind of business that we do. It's not tourism for the sake of it, but it's more really conveying the wilderness experience of the park. And currently we are revamping many of these units because some of them were built in the 1930s. A very encouraging trend, Chairperson, is really to see the number of black visitors that are roaming our parks. We'll be seeing a lot of that over the festive season.
our transformation efforts have really paid dividends. It's so heartwarming and fulfilling to see black families, map in hand, binoculars around the neck, clad in safari gear, and really enjoying themselves. Something that is, you know, was never thought of to be a reality, in, you know, 12 or 13 years ago. And that's an example of some of these experiences that we're talking about. Those are the visitor demographics. Residents, South African residents, up to about 77.6% of our visitors are still South Africans, and the rest is displaced. The United States still left behind the rest of the international sources of our tourists, and Germany slightly dropped from 32% of the share of the market share to about 28.4%. So we still drove that 30% or so of visitors from international from countries internationally, and then the rest is indeed South African. So parks serve the interests of South Africa first before those of the international community. The topical subject that we are dealing with, Jefferson, rhino poaching is a scourge. The National Prosecuting Authority, the Hawks, all law enforcement agencies, national intelligence are working with us in the National Crime Prevention Unit that has been put up or set up by government to try and stop this scourge. We've also engaged in international engagement with countries that we know are destinations for poached rhino horn. We've had a meeting with the ambassador of Vietnam, and subsequently we've been able to send a delegation there to try and establish working relationships with those countries and deal with this problem in a multi-pronged approach. So all the conservation agencies and private rhino owners are involved in this effort to fight rhino poaching. So these are the incidents that have taken place since January this year. And Chair, you will see that the last October, November months do indicate a decline in terms of the green, which is in the Kruger National Park, our largest concentration of rhino, between 11 and 13,000 as we speak. And the arrests have increased. I think there's one more arrest to about 229 people that we've arrested, suspects that have been arrested this year. And we tragically lost one poacher in a gun battle with our rangers in the Kruger National Park about 4 weeks, 3 weeks ago. It is indeed a war out there, Jefferson. It's not easy. When I was when I joined this organization, I was never told that I would be a commander of an army, but we sit with one. That is the only response that you can give to rhino poaching at this stage. The criminals are heavily armed, and lives are at risk, and we have to protect our people and the rhinos with all what we have. Still on rhino poaching, that shows just the trend. We are currently, this was a projected amount, but we are currently at 251 rhinos that we've lost countrywide, not just at some parks. We coordinate the stats for the whole country in the private or privately owned nature reserves and also state owned. So we sit at 251, just one more close to the 252 projection. So we think that by the end of this year we will be just around under 300. And as you can see, because of the tighter security in state-owned private nature reserves, in state-owned nature reserves and national parks, we have all kinds of problems with the private sector, because there are challenges in terms of security in some of the properties owned by private people. They can't afford the level of security and protection that the state has. But the National Crime Prevention Wildlife Prevention Unit works across the board, protecting both state and privately owned land. The biggest question that I get asked, Chair, is whether this poses a threat in terms of the viability of our population, whether the impact of rhino poaching will indeed create problems for our population, which is the only healthiest population in the world. If we continue on the red line, if poaching continues at the current rate and there is no change in terms of us winning the battle, we will start seeing the drop around 2012, 2013 to 2014. And that will only happen if the number of rhinos that are poached per annum are more than 1,000. Currently, it's just under 300, and we want to reduce rather than to see that number growing. It may pose a serious problem, Chase, if we don't win this war. But population with no poaching, it will increase. We're looking at about, by 2014, we might be sitting at around 28,000 or so, because the increase rate is about 11.6% per annum on white rhino. There's been a concern around the taking off of or the removal rate of rhinos. First, Chair, let me indicate that we don't take out rhino or take off rhino from existing populations for financial gain. We use that as a means to spread the gene pool. That's managing risk. And also we use it to create metapopulations in historical rhino rangelands in South Africa, whether that is owned by the state or by the private sector. That is the intention of the takeoff. And currently we're only taking off, we were taking off just between one, historically between one and 1.6 to, in between 1.6 and 0.2% per annum. However, because of studies that we've conducted, we've looked at the natural limitations and decided on the difference between the national the natural limitations and the dispersal limits based on our statistical distribution of removal. So we only take out around about 3.2. That's what is recommended, 3.2%. But in reality, it's not possible to take out 350 rhinos from the Kruger National Park and distribute them around the country or in any other reserve. So basically, this is the history. We've only managed to put them through auctions, through transfer to different partners. Over the years, up to 2010, we've done only 138. So even if we have those recommended takeoff, it's not possible to take so many of them out. But we're also conscious now in terms of the security of those destinations where the rhinos are being taken to and the people that are involved. And as soon as we learn of any criminal activity in a person's record, we remove those people from the list of buyers or people that have access to the rhinos, and we are advised by the security people involved in that. That includes the National Prosecuting Authority. Another area, Chair, of importance, we haven't experienced any elephant loss in the last 10, 12 years. No elephant has been poached, and the question is why? Simply because there is no market for ivory. Although we've seen a huge rise in elephant poaching in Mozambique and Zimbabwe, just across the border, but we haven't experienced any at this point in time. And that has created perceptions, I call them opinions or perceptions amongst all of us. We talk of too many elephants, others say no, there are too few. And those are opinions.
based on different challenges that we've had. So we've had to rely on science management interaction in terms of really what are we dealing with here in the context of this heterogeneity of creating variability in terms of time and space. So how many of us have been able to count elephants or been involved in elephant counting? In the room? Can we try? Can you see some elephants? How many? How many? 22. I've had 22, 6. I've had 4. I've had 7. Now, I think what? 5. Okay. So, this is what is happening out there. There are people that think there are too many elephants. You have to make this decision in 3 seconds, flying in a helicopter or a fixed-wing plane, and count. So we counted up to 22, and then I think the lowest was 4. There's only 10 elephants. So 1 to 10. Now that tells you how far off the mark we can be. We can no longer rely on how many elephants are in the Kruger National Park or in Sesuwe Umfolozi, but we can only look at how much time do they take or spend in a particular area, for how long, how do they move, observe all those movements, and record the temporal and spatial variability. That is how we are managing them now. And that has helped us to look at other things that we can do. For example, if you look at this slide, the first slide shows, well, the first graph shows an increase in terms of elephants up to about 12,000-13,000. And then we close artificial water points by half. The red dots were indicating a 6% growth, and now per annum it is about 3%. So through understanding these variabilities, you are able to intervene where appropriate and deal with issues that we're dealing with. So this is the outcome of scientific advancement that we've had in really amongst our ecologists in studying elephants, and we are comfortable, Chair, that culling still remains an option, but it's not really the first port of call for us. We are looking at different options in terms of understanding how we manage elephants. The new baby, Jagalas, has arrived. That's how a gecko looks like, for those that haven't seen. It's not an Alsatian. I'm sure we have picked up information in the media about jackal culling at Addo and Karoo and other parks. But really the challenge that we have is that we are following a new ecological paradigm, managing ecological processes. We have problems in small parks because there you have a situation where the natural systems that control the ecology, the environment there, are absent in some instances, particularly where you have predators, natural predators. That's the same problem that we're experiencing at Table Mountain with the baboons, because the leopard is no longer here to take off some of the numbers of baboons that are now raiding houses and creating huge problems in the city. In small parks, we are working on a system to restore large predators by mimicking the social processes that existed before. And this, we think, will assist us. It's a very management-intensive program. So the outcry, mainly by animal rights organizations, are misplaced. The issue here is that we are managing, we are restoring those natural social processes, which are now absent in those smaller parks, and hence we're experiencing problems. At Karoo and Addo, we saw a decline in some of the ungulate species, particularly springboks. At Karoo, we added, we bought quite a number of springboks that we added there, but they still disappeared, but we didn't see the bones and everything that was left off. So we said, we thought it couldn't be the drought. And we started looking at the jackal population, which has increased in tremendously. If you take out, for example, in 2 days, 132 jackals in Karoo, that's a lot of jackals. And that they've created a predator trap. So that when the springboks lamb, they take off all the young ones, and you end up without any population growth because of this problem. So we decided that we should cull them, and in those three places, that's what happened. We had pre-intervention densities of jackals, and the surveys, we looked at also the springbok concentrations as well. And the focus now is on post-intervention surveys. We're working with the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University to study the contents of these jackals in terms of their diets, so that those results can assist us in managing jackals in a much better way in future. And the study will be peer-reviewed, and probably the results will be available by 2012. Fires. So much on our television screens about fires and how an experiment went out. But in a nutshell, based on work that William Bond from UCT did for us, and Brian van Velken from the CSIR, we have noted that over the years, CO2 concentrations in Kruger and other savannas have increased, and that's the effect of climate change. And very clearly, in a savanna system, there's always a war between the grasses and the trees. And in this case, the trees are winning. Now, we want heterogeneity. We want those different spatial and temporal landscapes to continue. If you look at the aerial photographs of the park, particularly Kruger, in the 1930s and now, those are two different places. Grasslands, open lands have disappeared, and the thickets have taken over. So the only way, the fires that we've had, lightning fires and other fires that we did, were very cold fires, and they had no effect in terms of changing the structure of the vegetation. And scientists then recommended that we should experiment with firestorms, which will be quite intensive to burn the trees and reduce bush thickening. So that is what is happening at this point in time. And again, it's an exercise, it's an experiment that will take years for us to accomplish, and we would love to submit it for peer reviewing. And I would hate a situation, Jefferson, where scientists are prevented from doing their work because there will be an outcry there of an old couple that is worried about, you know, why a rhino got bent into the system. We are not managing rhinos or animals at an individual animal level. Otherwise, we will end up having to give them 12,000 names and call them by name. But we're managing them at an ecosystem level. So despite all the precautions, we lost 7 rhinos and a number of other animals, smaller animals. No one mentioned the poor snake and the impalas. Another issue, Chair, which is within this financial year, we report on it. It's the question of fishing at Tsitsikamma. That's the oldest MPA that we have in South Africa, the most beautiful. Andrew, I'm not so sure. We need to have a competition between Ismangaliso and Tsitsikamma and see who will come tops in terms of the beauty contest. That's the coastline of the Tsitsikamma and part of the MPA with the rest camp right at the bedrock. We received a memorandum from the Tsitsikamma Angling Community around about 2004 after a match. I always say, when I see a lot of people abroad in the city center, that, you know, in our country, we always see so many people if there's a match, not when they're shopping. So we had a match on the 27th, and they gave us this demand that they want fishing rights restored to them.
the want to fish in the park, and I mean those seized a long time ago, long before I even joined the organization. It ran about early 1990s. So a ministerial task team was then put in place to investigate and formulate a response in terms of these fishing issues. And there was a proposal that a 10-kilometer stretch of the MPA be opened to controlled fishing by members of the forum on an experimental basis. And this would, of course, be done in terms of the Marine Living Resources Act, Section 83. Let me hasten to say, despite all these recommendations, our board was skeptical. And I still remember Dr. Bob Falls really taking the lead in that board, the previous board, to say, we cannot allow extraction of any form in a marine protected area, especially one like Tsitsikamma. And the matter was taken to the previous minister, Mr. Van Schalkwyk, who then turned down the proposal. Now, unfortunately, the matter refuses to die, honorable members. It keeps on coming back. And on the 15th of October, the Deputy Minister, Joyce Mabudafasi, went to a Marine Week function at Tsitsikamma and met with this community. And the community raised the issue again. And she said, well, the matter is, especially when they talk about fishing rights and quotas, that's outside the scope of our mandate. It is now a responsibility of the Department of Agriculture and Forest, Fisheries and Forestry. So she indicated to them that she will return with a response end of November. At no stage did the Board of South African National Park, which is the management, the accounting authority for this park, took a decision to open Tsitsikamma MPA for fishing. There are no such plans. Let me emphasize, there are no such plans to open the Tsitsikamma MPA to fishing. The board has pronounced on this matter previously, and I think when approached, it will pronounce itself again. That's Baboon Fury coming from Table Mount. Just for interest's sake, those canines are longer than that of a lion. They are between 6 and 7 centimeters. Our relationship with the City of Cape Town has soured over the last 6 months, Chair, regarding the management of baboons and how Sanparks plays a role there. Our mandate really does not allow us to manage baboons in cities and towns. The baboons are found everywhere, or other animals that live our national parks. We cannot manage those outside the ambit of parks. It's an issue that we have engaged with the city, we are discussing. However, in the heat of the moment, some of the councillors of the city have been calling for the taking back of Table Mountain National Park, and we've indicated that that is not our responsibility. It's a matter that they will have to take up at an appropriate political level. It would really be an incomplete report if we do not report on Hangberg, the Battle of Hangberg, as it is now known. We were allocated a piece of land in 1999, Chairperson, and at that time, that unregistered piece of land in Hout Bay was already occupied by a small informal settlement, which the city consented to. We then agreed that the upper edge of this border of the development would be the slot, and a 15 meter fire break would then be maintained above the slot. We bought F1510. I'll show those just the lower part of Sentinel property. I'll show that to the committee in the next slide. And we engaged in discussions with the city because we already had squatters there. And the idea was that
this area, which is really quite small, comparatively speaking, would be excised, given back to the city, and then be used as a buffer between the developed areas and the natural area. But then, as we were discussing, that small component, land invasion happened above the Sluat in August 2009. First on city land, and then mainly later on park land. So together with the city, having briefed our lawyers, we agreed that the city, because this is a housing matter, the city would be the first applicant, and Sunparks would be a second applicant. That was the agreement. And the city filed the main affidavit to the Cape High Court. We did not file any affidavit. However, later on it appeared that we were now cited as the first applicant in the case, contrary to the agreement that we had with the city. And that created a problem because this was primarily a housing problem, which then affected conservation. We then withdrew from the case, and of course, all is history now. We know what happened at Tangberg after the meeting, after the premier met with those communities, and the demolition of the 29 unoccupied dwellings. We are still part of the application as respondents, because our interest really lies in sorting out the invasion on parkland. And once that has been sorted out, we hope that we can find a settlement. And we were happy with a discussion first in terms of the eviction law. It says there should be a discussion, and then there must be an alternative land that is identified. And the High Court then confirmed our view in terms of discussion first before we seek eviction. So that is the challenge on Hangberg. Honorable members, I thought that you will be asked about these questions, and I've seen some of the inquiries coming from the committee that it's important that we reflect on it. And that is Hangberg. For those that may not be aware, Chairman, may I have you? This is the area that is involved, and originally these are some of the shacks that were on the area, and you can see some of them have already crossed, and the fire break runs somewhere there. And that needs to be sorted out. The red line really indicates how the border between the park and the settlement should have been. And so you've got really quite a number of people that are there, and these are some of the destroyed structures, the removed structures, and this is Table Mountain, and that's part of that land that we bought some years back, and we hope that perhaps it will create a better buffer between the community and ourselves. But land is scarce in the peninsula, we understand that, and I think the approach to resolve this problem will be different from other approaches that we have been involved in previously. Mapungubwe, the mining that has caused all the problems. Chair, that is Vele Coilery, and it is on the eastern bound of the Mapungubwe National. All these green areas are Sunparks managed land, and the orange is not part of the yellow. The yellow, I don't know what that is. The amber colors represent pieces of land that are not part of Mapungubwe Heritage, World Heritage Site. We are in the process of consolidating all these little pieces in between there, and then the mine is there. So it's about 6 to 7 kilometers away from the park. And that's the Environmental Education Center, the center at Mapungubwe, constructed in terms of to fit and blend with the environment, and some of the artifacts that are housed there. But the challenge that we have at Mapungubwe is that the environmental management plan that that whole process did not take into consideration many of our concerns. We lodged an official objection, which was not taken into consideration. We did inform the department about it. And suddenly the department has also, of late, instructed, ordered the mine to cease operation. I think it was about June, July this year. Operations have ceased, and the challenge is now with us retaining our World Heritage status. UNESCO is sending a fact-finding mission that we will be meeting on the third week of November to discuss this matter. We remain an interested and affected party, but unfortunately we don't have regulatory and monitoring powers to deal with this matter, so it's dealt with by our department. Chair, I thought these are the main critical issues that the committee would have wanted to know about, and perhaps that would minimize also some of the issues that have been flying around, and I'm sure the committee is now well informed in terms of these challenges that have been grazing our screens, our television screens and newspapers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mabunda. Honorable Morgan?
Thank you, Dr. Mabunda. Okay, so a couple of questions. I said you took the liberty to raise a whole bunch of issues as well that both are inside the financial year and outside the financial year. One of the issues which you didn't raise, which I'm very interested in, is what, if any, is your involvement at Sandparks into the minister's study into a review of parks in South Africa completely. I'm aware that DEA has done a study that was presented to MINMEC very, very recently that looks at the problems associated with parks. And it's probably a little bit early to comment, but as far as I know, only about three of your parks effectively subsidize the whole, effectively subsidize most of the running of the other parks. Five parks, I guess. That's an improvement. Okay. Anyway, the point made is that conservation is in general heavily underfunded in South Africa. In fact, the figure that I am aware of for the whole country at the moment with regards to it is, wrong page here, is about 3.4 billion rand short for conservation in South Africa, which I know, Dr. Abrams is no doubt very concerned about. Okay, so look, we raised this in the strategic workshop this year as well. I mean, I think it's completely unacceptable that conservation is so underfunded. I don't agree with Treasury's approach to maximizing revenue for any of these entities at all. And I don't agree with any of them having to ever be self-funding either. I mean, there has to be a robust fight going on with Treasury, Dr. Mabunda, because, I mean, it looks like, I mean, you're having your funding ever so, you probably say it's not been slightly cut, but it's reducing, and the trend is probably only one way in all this. So what, if anything, is being done to obviously convince Treasury to give conservation more money? You can answer for Sandparks. It's not fair for you to answer either of you. The reality, of course, is that if indeed we do change the way who owns parks or who manages parks, because I suspect, and you may not want to comment on this, the National Department probably wants to cherry pick a few provincial parks and put them in your fleet of parks. But that leaves a whole bunch of other parks which are fundamentally unviable in South Africa. I don't know what would happen to them.
regards to fishing in Sitsi Kama, thank you for that. It's reassuring to know that you haven't, the board hasn't changed its line. Of course, I see on your slides that the Deputy Minister said that she would look at the issue again, which no doubt means it has to come back to you for another decision. I hope that you will indeed keep the line. Now, I'm not unsympathetic to the needs of coastal communities. Indeed, the small-scale fishing policy, notwithstanding its own problems, will seek to obviously provide opportunities to a lot more fisherfolk along the coast, and that is a good thing. But considering that many, many species rejuvenate themselves within the bounds of Sitsi Kama and other MPAs, there has to be an argument that the long-term sustainability of fisheries, particularly for the most poor and vulnerable people along our coast, actually relies on the sustainability of fisheries. And MPAs are one of those relief areas for fisheries. And you used an interesting analogy when you talked about the fire. You said, you know, let's not, you know, you have to look at the kind of macro system. You know, let's not name the animal. Well, actually, it applies the same to people as well. Because we can't make policies based on just a few fisher people along the coast, actually. I mean, the political decision-making is hard. I accept, and I accept the Deputy Minister may be under some particular stress on this issue. But we, you know, have to find other opportunities for people. The reality is not everyone can be a fisherman, can be a fisherman or woman. So I trust you will hold that line. I'm vehemently against the opening of Sitsi Kama to fishing. With regards to baboon management, can you answer this question? What is fundamentally the difference between a lion escaping from Table Mountain from Kruger National Park and wandering into a neighboring village, or an elephant, or any number of other animals? A very vicious rabid jackal? A honey badger? That's particularly what? You get my picture. What's fundamentally different, Mr. Mabunda, from those animals? Because I realize, I mean, when those animals escape from Kruger National Park, you have contractors who catch, drive, eliminate those animals from the size of the park. So, I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, so why not baboons? What's so fundamentally difficult, the difference between baboons and lions or other animals? So, good, and that's a philosophical question for you to get your mind around there. I mean, of course, the issue here, I mean, is conservation is underfunded in every tier of government, in local governments, in provincial governments, and national governments. And, of course, they're going to be robust confrontation, not confrontation, debate between different spheres of government about who manages these kinds of things. So I'd be interested in your views on that. And then with regards to Hungberg, I mean, why did you allow, when the invasion first happened last year, that you didn't put an eviction order in at that time? I mean, I'm well aware that your officials in Cape Town, in Sand Park, were well on board with their court papers for several weeks. And then something happened, Dr. Mabunda, something over a particular weekend, which fundamentally changed your mind on it. I mean, it came from you. You're in the court papers yourself, and I read your court papers as well. So, you know, what changed? How did you suddenly become aware of this particular issue? I mean, did a politician phone you and give you a bit of a bonneting about it? Because that's what your officials in Table Mountain National Park are telling me. That's just when someone phoned you and said, we really need to change your view on this. You know, it's fascinating that Itimangaliso Wetland Park, and you'll understand why I asked Mr. Zulumis those questions. Because, of course, he's taken a very strong line on unauthorized structures in his park, and indeed, fascinating. The minister was one of the applicants in one of those cases. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It's fascinating. And we've got problems all around South Africa, Dr. Mabunda. Ndumo is, I know it's not your responsibility, is a complete mess. Hundreds of people have moved into that park.
that in Mpumalanga Provincial Park, I forget the name, Forangela, complete mess as well. So, you know, to look at something from, I bet you those land invaders in Mpumalanga regarded as a housing issue as well. I bet you the land invaders in Nduma regarded as a housing issue. And I would think that in terms of, the, you know, the legislation, that protecting the mandate of conservation is what comes first. And I have genuine concerns for the future of conservation in South Africa. And notwithstanding, you know, I also hate the kind of the politics of all of this. But obviously, understanding the fact that we obviously have to we've set aside certain protected areas and need to protect that, and not create precedents which make it much more difficult to act against. Yeah. So I'm interested in that, and I realize it's a very, very tough issue for you, Dr. Mabunda, as well. But defending our national parks, defending all of our parks, is something which surely has to happen. And the only thing that signal we send when we're soft on these issues is that encroachment into parks is an action which is not necessarily going to get any response. So thank you very much.
Dr. Mabunda, I have got about 2-4 questions for you. Dr. Mabunda, in Vilavila, a certain Dr. Koi and his girlfriend have removed horn of rhinos from their farm and then applied to the department for a permit to possess the horn. They hadn't got the permit when they were visited by people who demanded the horn, which amounted to theft. Don't you find it strange that they went to apply for a permit and they were robbed of their horn immediately? Is there no between the people who issued the permit and some facts? Secondly, how is it possible that a helicopter will land on land controlled by SANParks or a private reserve undetected? That they will shoot the animal without anybody hearing shots, remove their horns, which must be time-consuming, and fly off free? Isn't there a degree of collusion again? What have you done about those helicopters that get into Kruger National Park or other parks and do the what I agree? On the 7th of this month, which is last Tuesday, we met with Wool Growers South Africa, and they came in to come and present their problems on the predator, the gecko, that they are running at a loss of about 306,000 rand per year. I'm not sure about the figures, they slip my mind. To say, isn't there a way that you SANParks, South African Wool Growers, Department of Police, Department of Agriculture, is there no way that you can sit and deal with this problem? Because the wool growers are now running at a loss because of predators. Secondly, the issue of Mapungubwe. How many baobab trees have been removed in the process of that mining business? Because for a baobab tree to grow into a big tree, it takes more than 100 years for it to be a matured baobab tree. And what happened to the trees that were removed there? Were they just left there, or they were transferred to other areas where they can continue with their life span? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
some of the questions you have answered to. Just one question. I don't know if it's a question, but I must say, really, we are appreciating what you have just presented to us. It's informative, because sometimes we did have so many questions that we wanted to ask. Is there people in Sandak are really seeing what we are seeing outside of the park, especially for the Mapungu Ngubwa? We appreciate your intervention, even although it needs a political mandate, but we really appreciated your effort to can stop, and now there is negotiation. We appreciated about it. The one that I still have a question is the one that Mama Mabuza have just alluded to, the one of the killing of rhinos. I'm just thinking loud, I don't know. I'm just wondering if maybe it's not encouraged by this cross border thing, because I'm just thinking loud. If I think maybe is that, if that is what I'm thinking, what is that in future we have to do to make sure that we maintain the agreement that we've got with this country. And then my last question is that, as you have shown on your slide, that most of the rhino and so forth, we have seen it now is escalating to other provinces. We have seen it happening in Northwest. So, didn't you think that these people, maybe they are amongst yourself at the park, because they will target it, that they will know where is those animals by that time. So I'm just saying, didn't you think maybe if some people whom you have hired, some they have come there to can look at the place, how can they inform others outside? Because hunger may direct somebody to do something that is seen. So I would just talk to them. Yeah, you can continue after some of the questions.
It is still a departmental role at this point in time, pretty much like researching the problem, formulating questions, and then obviously there will be another phase in which institutions like us will be brought on board, CNB and the others. But at this point in time, it's still very much a departmental exercise with merit. In terms of looking at how conservation in general in South Africa is managed, we know that the findings of the Kumleben report were not taken on board, but hopefully, perhaps this time around, we'll have a viable alternative. One that does not cherry-pick the best assets around the country, but one that really brings in our own version of heterogeneity, where you can manage different types of parks in a sustainable manner. Hence, I like the idea of the Protected Areas Act that says, cost them, tell us how much they will cost, so that by at the end of this exercise, we can submit a business case that in order to manage South Africa's natural assets or parks in particular, this is what will be required. A minimum of this then would go a long way in addressing the problems. Otherwise, we would be simply just moving the chairs on the deck and not changing the direction of the ship. We are from time to time engaged with Treasury. The CFO has had those kind of engagements with Treasury, where we discuss really the role of parks and the, you know, the best way in terms of funding. And I think at this point in time, we lost our part of our land acquisition grant simply because of the inability of the fiscus to collect enough money from as a result of the or enough revenue as a result of the recession. But there are constant engagements with the budgeting people at Treasury to say, look, we are grossly underfunded and we need you know to be assisted. There's only 5 parks that are realizing a surplus, again with tremendous injection from different sources. We need to bring all parks perhaps to a level where they can at least break even. But some parks, in reality, Honorable Chairperson, they will never make money. Biodiversity is not here to create money. We must just manage it for the well-being of our nation, and that is an important message. Fishing at Tsukama, Honorable Chairperson, we will always be guided by science. We will always interact with our stakeholders, the marine community, which a lot of independent scientists and people that have studied this area for a very long time. And we will advise the board accordingly, as we have advised the board in the past, in terms of what are the best options to take without creating problems in terms of or being unsympathetic to the needs of the community. So we'll always advise the board accordingly, as we have always done. There is no difference between a baboon escaping from Table Mountain into Baitekat Street or a lion escaping from Malelane into Malelane portion of the Kruger National Park into the TSB area where there's lots of people. The difference, though, Honorable Morgan, is the way in which state agencies, tiers of government, cooperate and interact with each other. When a lion escapes from the Kruger National Park or a head of elephants, because they normally go out as breeding heads, invade the sugar canes around Cape Maiden, the first people to assist, to be on the scene to manage the situation in terms of the protocol, the existing protocol for the country, is the Provincial Conservation Agency. It is the Department of Environment in Mpumalanga or Limpopo, working with their own 2 agencies. Normally, they don't have they don't have helicopters. They don't have technical support. That's when we come in and assist them in terms of the technical support. I have offered. I had a. You will be pleased to know, Morgan, that it's. Today is my actually my second trip to Cape Town. On Monday I was here, meeting with the city manager of the city manager of Cape Town and his team, and we did offer our technical expertise in the same way as we offer to other provinces to assist them in managing baboons. However, they have one option that they are looking at. And we did ask them to look at the other option of mimicking the natural system in the absence of a leopard. How can that, because we need to bring, to approach this in a multi-pronged manner. You can't deal with baboons by simply having monitors waving red flags and shy shushing them away. You need also to manage the size of the population. There is enough food for them, they are. They are exploding in terms of the population. It's hard to go and look for roots and bitter fruits on the mountain, so it's much easier to come for ice cream in the houses, and that's what they're doing. So we need then also to manage the population. Once we're managing, we have monitors that are just making sure that the surroundings are safe, go into the population and manage the population itself, because that is the problem. And I can understand the reluctance to manage the population because of the criticism that will come from the friends of the baboons, the baboon coalition, and all the type of things that happen in our sector. So managers are often scared of taking action based on what they know can work, and always take this long winding route, which at the end of the day can be very difficult for our political principals to justify the expenditure, say for example on managing lions and baboons, as compared to managing other socio-economic needs. So we need to strike the balance. As conservationists, there are certain things that we can do, which we have learned, which we have practiced, which are successful, to reduce populations and manage them. A smaller, manageable population of baboons can be under control. But at the moment, the situation is out of control, and we need to be bold enough and say, let's model the size of the population and what percentage can we take out, and see what form of take out we agree on. Because those tools are available to me as an environmental, as a conservation manager. And that's the difficult $64,000 question that we are afraid to address. So it's really cooperation between us, the provincial agencies, the department in the province, which is a regulatory authority, and then the city as well. So there shouldn't be a problem. Hangberg, when we got the land, it already had squatters. When Public Works gave us the land, they were already occupiers on the land. Ms. Morgan, I am very happy to say to this committee, I had no phone call from anybody. If there was a phone call, it was to the DG, not to me. I was on my way to Australia, and I received papers, court papers, which had been served to my office here, the regional office. And then when I looked at the papers, I realized that we were cited as, I had to do a lot of, sign off a lot of things, and I realized we were cited as the first applicants. And our instruction, written instruction, to Nongoko Nuku Incorporated, who are our lawyers representing us, was that we would be the second applicants, because the interest of conservation is indeed involved there. We will not compromise. We have not compromised at Golden Gate. However, in seeking redress, we will not break the laws. We will go through the prescript of what the Eviction Act says. The Eviction Act says, first engage the community, negotiate with those occupiers, and then bring in other role players like your municipality to find alternative accommodation or alternative relief for those people that will be evicted. And then once that has been certified, you can then carry out an eviction. So all of that had not happened. That's why the High Court decision or ruling was go back to the community, negotiate with the community, come back here on the 29th of November. So we are going to court back on it. We are still interested, and the interest of conservation will not be compromised. We don't want to create a precedent for the country to be unable to manage land invasions in protected areas in future. So that is the reason why we are still involved in the case, but in a different context, not as the first applicant. Bila Bila, the dehorning of horns, Chairperson, is really something that has come from the private sector, and they are encouraging it. But we realize that this thing is going to exacerbate the situation unless you have proper controls in terms of what the dehorning itself must be supervised. There should be a proper process that says horn A has been removed from rhino A, and then that rhino horn should be marked as such and be entered into some sort of dehorned so many rhinos, and the horns are kept, and they've been audited by your internal or external auditors. That would be a controllable situation. It would then control this type of things. But dehorning is happening without proper controls in place, and the department is looking at this as a regulatory authority. I know even some provincial conservation agencies are involved in this dehorning without putting in place proper control measures. So that allows then the kind of criminal activities that you've just cited, Chairperson. But I know it was reported to the police and it's been dealt with. One would not rule out the human element. Whenever these things happen, the human element is not on holiday. It is always present. Even in the issuing of permits, we do have our suspicions that there is collusion between the people who issue permits, the people who manage immigration activities, because the only way you can take out a rhino trophy or horn is if you have a permit and it's properly accounted for through immigration. So those are definitely linked. The helicopter landing and removing of horns with precision thing has been happening. It happened very close to where I live in Ritzvlei Dam, in Pretoria East. And those who saw the helicopter say it landed just for about between 10 and 12 minutes. Because we now know that vets are involved, pilots are involved, people with military training, the kind of precision that you need to effect this kind of an action quickly, it is possible that they do these things. Again, we may not rule inside work, inside job sort of collusion kind of work. But in our case, we've prosecuted a traffic cop who was involved in this type of activities. And so far, we haven't had any other issue, Chairperson, around our own staff getting involved in this type of thing. The JCOL program that we have around Ado and Karoo was partly an attempt to address losses by dog farmers. And I think in that context, working with the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, we'll be able to find a solution, but also it requires a bigger debate in terms of dealing with these losses. Because on the one hand, you have farmers that are saying we are losing our livestock. On the other hand, you have the Landmark Foundation saying don't kill jackals. They are part of our biodiversity. No matter what they do and no matter where they are, don't touch them. So that creates a difficult situation. The baobab trees that were removed from by Vele Koiler when they started their mining, I don't know where they took them to, but they opened a very huge landing strip which destroyed many species of vegetation. Hence, the department stepped in to stop them. I don't know where they've kept that, and it was without notice to us. Honorable Mazani, the issue of rhino poaching escalating in other provinces as a result of insider job, we cannot rule it out, but the National Crime, Environmental Crime Unit is working on all kinds of leads to stop this type of things. Yeah, in a nutshell, that would be the response.
Thank you, Dr. Mabunda. Thank you for your can I allow South Africa with a question to present over to you, Master?
Sure,
the follow-up?
Yes. The Chairperson, I've got some reservations about this proceeding with another presentation. We are two members of Parliament here, and the House is going to sit in about half an hour's time. I would like to request that we, well, I see another one's coming up, but I'd like to request, notwithstanding the inconvenience we've called forward, for them to come back next week so we can do proper justice to the presentation. I feel bad about having three MPs here and a rushed amount of time.
Honourable Morgan, is it not going to be
a wasteful expenditure. That will next time question to say there was this expenditure. I don't know, and I don't know how will they feel. But if you agree with me, just allow them to present. And we ask questions and we request them to send us responses. I don't know.
I think we have to balance expenditure against doing justice to our legislative oversight job. The point is, I've got another engagement in 10 minutes of time, so that reduces you to two members of parliament.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honourable members. I think as a South African Weather Service, we are in your hands, but I think it would be important that we actually have some time to present some of the activities that we've been doing. And maybe we were also planning to also present one of our projects that we've launched, the flood guidance project. So maybe to also present us with more time to do that presentation.
Okay, think about it.
Yes, sir. I think that the time is gone now, because even now we are supposed to be in a memorial service. So I think it would be impossible for them to present, because we need time to engage on their presentation. So we are sorry for that.
Thank you, honourable members. South Africa Weather Service, they don't have any programs. So we will slot them for next week, Wednesday. Okay, that brings us to the end of this.
Sorry, Chair. Just one thing. I think as part of celebrating 150 years, South African Weather Service has actually compiled a paper book that has got years, that has got some information dating from 150 years as part of knowledge management. And each member has got that book.
Thank you very much.
It looks
very impressive, and I will put it on my
pocket. Oh, thank you. Okay. Honourable members, can we agree with them that we our meeting be done through video conference? Can we do that?
In fact, I
would
fully support
that. Yeah, let's do it through video conference. Thank you very much for your understanding.
No, I don't know.